was first given to the House.
Good morning. The Senate Interim Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. It's not May 20th anymore. It's May 23rd. Welcome back. The spring is upon us, theoretically. It's a little wet out there. We have a pretty full agenda today, and we will move through it. Some of our presenters will be coming and going to other hearings where they need to be offering some information to other committees. So we're going to start by opening an informational meeting on with the Oregon Health Authority, an update on mental health foster home rate changes. And we'll invite Justin Hopkins. Good morning, Justin. Thanks for being first up today.
Good morning. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Justin Hopkins. I'm the Contracts and Compliance Director for the Health Systems Division of the Oregon Health Authority. The purpose for my testimony today is to provide the committee with an update to OHA's February testimony regarding adult foster homes and to answer any questions the committee may have. During the public hearing in February, the committee heard from several adult foster home providers who were concerned about the impact of a new rate methodology and the impact that rate methodology might have on their financial viability. So in response to that, OHA has been monitoring the number of homes that have closed since the first of the year when the new rate methodology went into effect. To date, there have been 11 adult foster homes that have closed down without reopening under another name or simply moving locations. We've also been monitoring the number of adult foster homes that have opened. And to date, there have been 5 new adult foster homes that have opened across the state. And we are currently processing 2 additional licensing applications. So there will be 7 new homes that have opened since January 2016. Of the 11 adult foster homes that have closed down since January, 5 of them were from Marion County. OHA and Marion County worked together to identify options and placements for the individuals who were impacted by the change in the rate methodology and the closure of the adult foster homes. Marion County did an amazing job working with their provider network across the continuum of care to find placements and make sure that services were wrapped around the individuals who were impacted. Marion County reported that there were 31 people total who were impacted by the adult foster home closures and the new rate methodology. Out of those 31 people, Marion County was able to find local resources for 29 people, only having to move 2 people outside of the county. 11 of those 29 people were transitioned into less restrictive, more independent and integrated community settings, such as supportive housing programs or moving in with family. 15 of those individuals were transitioned to other adult foster homes, so the same level of care. And only 3 people transitioned into higher levels of care, and that was really based on their current needs.
Can I ask a question? For the individuals that moved in with family, was that a primary choice of the individual and their family, or was that just default, the only thing that was available to them, so they weren't kind of out on the street?
Chair Gelser, I'd have to defer to Marion County for the specific information.
And I know we don't have time today to bring Marion County up, but if Marion County's here, I'd be interested in learning that moving forward. I think most family members would do whatever they can, even if they aren't necessarily resourced to be able to do that. I want to make sure that we're not kind of pushing that that challenge onto families and individuals where they're not going to be successful in the long term.
Absolutely. So I'm not sure if it was an interim plan or more of a long-term plan. It could be that family was the best option in the short term while they're identifying a longer-term option.
And that leads to another question. It would be helpful to know, of the 31 that moved, how many of those new placements are long-term permanent new placements and how many of them are temporary placements looking for other options?
Chair Gelser, my understanding is that probably just the 2 people that moved out of county would be considered really those short-term placements. I think they used respite as an option.
Right.
My understanding is that the other folks are more of a permanent placement while they're getting the services they need to step down into more integrated settings.
But weren't those that went to the family homes, that 11, wasn't that part of the 31? And you weren't sure if that was a short-term or a permanent?
Yes, I'm sorry. Only 2 people ended up going to family homes. So 9 of the people who stepped down actually went to more of a supportive housing type situation, so an independent living situation in the community.
Thank you.
here.
Yes.
Out of the ones that closed, were there any that were special needs foster care, adult foster care? Well, first, how many are adult foster care, and how many are child? Do you have that broken out on the ones that closed? And then I wanted to know, basically I want to know, are we losing our special needs foster care homes, adult?
Chair Gelser, Senator Monica Anderson. The foster homes that we're talking about are all adult foster homes, so there weren't any children impacted by this. And as far as special needs, we actually have just one license that covers all adult foster homes under the Oregon Health Authority, so to serve people who have mental illness. So we don't have any sort of special credential for special needs population adult foster homes.
But the increase in the minimum wage, with the minimum wage increase, is going to affect the special needs. And I was just wondering if we have any data regarding the effect that that's going to have on the special needs foster care homes. And I'm not sure if we're understanding each other.
So I think one of the challenges is that the Oregon Health Authority is looking specifically at the adult mental health foster homes. The bigger foster home, just most of our adult foster homes in the state are managed by the Department of Human Services, and this is that smaller subset of Oregon Health Authority.
And I'm looking at the other bigger picture. Okay.
If there's any information we can bring back to the committee around our population, we'd be happy to do that.
And I'm sure Clyde heard that for his team, that that's a question that's coming later.
So again, I just wanted to acknowledge the tremendous effort by Marion County Mental Health and their staff and the local provider network to step up and meet the needs of these individuals during this challenging time. I know that Marion County was creative. They developed some new capacity at lower levels of care and were quick to work with providers to also develop new adult foster home capacity. So I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Well, and when you were here before, a couple of the concerns that we heard, there were some questions about the information about property tax abatement for adult foster home facilities and income tax abatement, and there was some confusion about, there was a lot of different information that was shared during the hearing. Has that been clarified and communicated to everyone?
Chair Gelser, we'd be happy to get information back to you on that. My understanding is there's a layer of county oversight there where the counties may have a role in deciding whether or not that's going to be applicable to the providers or not. So we'd be happy to get our analysis back to you on that.
I think that would be really helpful. And the other was there were concerns raised that there isn't currently a contract with the adult foster homes for mental health. Has that been resolved? Are we close to a contract?
Are you referring to the collective bargaining agreement?
Yes.
So my understanding is that the collective bargaining agreement has been ratified, but there's still an exceptional needs rate discussion going on that resulted from a grievance, and so that wasn't part of the original collective bargaining agreement.
That's great. Thank you. And then when you get the other information, if you could follow that up also to the Senate President's office, who's really been following this pretty closely, I think they will want any updates you have on the individuals, the permanency of those placements, and any additional closures and the progress of the rate and the property tax piece.
Absolutely.
Anyone else?
Chair, I do think the property tax is a county issue. And so it's going to be different county by county as to how they approach it.
Great. Any other questions? No? All right. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to close the informational hearing on adult mental health foster home rate changes and open up an informational hearing on a whole lot of things at the Oregon Department of Human Services. So I would invite up Clyde Psyche and Dr. Richardson and anybody else you want to bring. And I think the way that we have it structured is kind of a general update about the department, some information about the leasing agreements, and then also obviously interest in updates around child welfare, the external review process, and your internal review related to Give Us This Day.
Right.
So, Chair Gessler and members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, interim director for the Department of Human Services. And the way we're going to structure it, we have some other people who will come up and talk to you about employment first and leasing and those issues. What Dr. Richardson and I are going to do is kind of give that overview of where we are and kind of an update. We're going to talk about personnel and organizational changes. I'll cover where we are on the external review for child welfare. And then Dr. Richardson's going to talk about challenges and issues as we kind of move forward. So, let me start with personnel changes. There have been several personnel changes that we've made since I joined the department in November. And the first two I want to talk about, we are indeed fortunate that I asked Dr. Richardson, after I'd been there a while, to step into the role as deputy director for the department. I think the way I broached the subject with him is that I had an opportunity for him, and he very thankfully agreed to the opportunity. I didn't tell him, give him any details, because I wanted him to step into the role. But then soon after that, unfortunately, we had a change in leadership in the child welfare program in DHS, and we needed an interim administrator for the child welfare program. And so I asked Dr. Richardson to assume that role for the time being as we recruit for a new child welfare director. So at this point in time, Dr. Richardson is actually wearing two hats, deputy director for the department and also interim administrator for the child welfare division. And we're indeed fortunate to have him in those roles. The second thing I want to talk about, as when I accepted the assignment from the governor, the one thing I kind of intuitively knew is that I needed someone who really could help me do analysis of the organization, the way we were structured, how things were working or not working, and how we would then, for things that weren't working, how we would move forward in fixing those issues. And I had worked with Janine Beatrice over the years, first in DHS, and we were both kind of recovering DHS employees at that time at the Department of Administrative Services. And so I asked her to come over with me on a temporary basis. And Janine has really been invaluable as far as helping us do organizational analysis. She's also helped during the 2015 legislative session, worked on Senate Bill 1515, and actually is working on the implementation of Senate Bill 1515, has also been kind of on point, the DHS point person on the child welfare assessment. So it's all those critical roles that you need someone to step into. And so when I agreed to stay on, I asked Janine to stay on with me, and thankfully she agreed to do that. So she's sitting in the back there. Janine, you want to raise your hand?
Hi, Janine.
And like I said, we're indeed fortunate to have her as part of the team. Soon after taking over, one of the things I realized is that we needed to make some changes in our aging and people with disabilities division. And so we did something that was kind of unique. We actually did a swap, and we took the director at that time, Mike McCormick, and his deputy, Ashley Carson Cottingham, and actually kind of reversed, flipped their roles. And Mike's very good at the budget and operational and policy. Ashley's very good at policy and I don't know if she'd admit this, but enjoys working with the legislature and stakeholders. So it just seemed that by having them reverse their roles, we actually put them in positions they were much better suited to, and it's worked out really well. And both of them, I think, are very happy with the change. And then since we promoted Dr. Richardson into the role of deputy director, it left a hole in our self-sufficiency program. Dr. Richardson had been the administrator of this self-sufficiency program and had been doing a great job. And he had been aided in those efforts by a very capable person as his deputy, Kim Friedland. And so upon promoting Dr. Richardson, we asked Kim to step up into the role of administrator for the Office of Self-Sufficiency. And she agreed, and she'll be testifying later this morning, and I think this might be the first time, so please be nice to her. And Kim, would you raise your hand? So,
yeah. Hi, Kim. Welcome.
As you know, we also made some personnel changes. We made some changes in the Child Welfare Department. We had two longtime people who, to be honest with you, are very good people who were very, I think, dedicated to kids in the state. However, due to circumstances and kind of my evaluation, I decided that if we were going to move child welfare to where we needed to be, we really, in order to facilitate that, we really needed to make a leadership change there. And so I asked the chief operating officer and the administrator of the child welfare division at that point in time to step down. And we are currently recruiting for a new child welfare director and hoping that we can get somebody on board as quickly as possible so I can have Dr. Richardson just do one job now. We also made a change in the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight. There was another opportunity for the administrator of that program, so she took a voluntary demotion to work in one of our other programs. Really, right now, we have an interim director there, but we're really taking a look at the way we do licensing in the department because I think you have windows of opportunity when it's really a good idea to take a step back and look at a function in the department and ask ourselves, is it really working the way we want it to work or it should be working? And we have that opportunity now with the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, ORO. And so, it seems like in government or organizations, sometimes you go through cycles of centralization and decentralization. My instruction in the people doing the analysis was, I just want you to go and do a deep dive, take a look at how we're doing business, come back to me and tell me, is the way we're doing business now, is this the right model? But it's not working because of leadership issues or resource issues or, why isn't it working? Or if it's not working, what is the right model? And then what will be gained by making some kind of a change? And that's kind of the way I'm approaching change throughout the organization. If we can't sit before anyone and look them in the eye and say, here's why we're doing it, here's what we hope to achieve, and here's how it's going to make things better, then we're not going to make a change because we can't afford to make change just for change's sake. After we finish with the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, I then want the team to take a look at the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations because I really, when you talk about safety, investigations and licensing are two critical parts of the equation, and I need to be assured that what we have in place is the best system in producing the kinds of results we have to have to ensure safety for our clients. So that's kind of where we are on the personnel and the organizational side. And before I start talking about the assessment, maybe I'll stop there and see if anybody has any questions or comments.
I do have a question. Just, sure. In terms of what you were just talking about, Clyde, what sort of timeline do you see yourself being on, to do the analysis and then?
Yeah. We actually are at the tail end of the licensing discussion, and if we make changes, probably they'll be implemented within the next month or two. And we're kind of right at the final stages of kind of writing things up and saying, here's why we're doing it, here's how it's going to, here's why we're doing it, and here's what we hope to achieve. So then we'll finish that one up and then move on to the Office of Investigations.
So. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair.
And welcome to the Senate.
And thank you for letting me sit in. Clyde, when you introduced yourself as the interim.
Yes.
And is it my understanding that your confirmation is this week?
Chair Gelser and Representative Stark, until the Senate votes, I will introduce myself as the interim because I never take anything for granted. Never want to assume anything. And yes, I'll be before the Senate Rules Committee at 2.
I think we can make an assumption.
So,
agree?
Just a question, something I wanted to put on the record. As you're having the conversation about AWAPI, and I know you and I have talked about this a little bit,
yeah.
Dr. Richardson and I have had a brief conversation. It's going to come up later today in the child care discussion. But the idea around having an entity that's doing investigations of non-family child maltreatment, just because the perspective of going into a family and dealing with family systems is very different than going into a child care facility, a licensed residential facility, in terms of the dynamics and the question of safety moving beyond a single child or family. That it's and I'm just hoping that can be part of that discussion moving forward.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, absolutely. They are two very different things. However, there is overlap, and again, you know, when we look at the way we're structured and the way we're functioning, sometimes we have the right organizational structure, but there are other factors that are preventing it from operating as efficiently as it can, whether it be communication, resources, leadership, a number of different things. And so, you know, that's my approach. I mean, I haven't charged people with saying we need to make a change, go in and tell me how to change it. My charge has been go in, do the evaluation, tell me if it's the right model, and if it is the right model, why isn't it working as well as it should be, and if not, what do we need to do to make it work the way we want? I think we should never approach an evaluation of a structure with a predetermined outcome in mind. The fact should lead us to the right outcome.
No, and I think that's very true. I just think a problem that's emerged, and whether it's structural or not structural, we have a series of places where people are mandatory reporters, and they are required to report to DHS, and then DHS actually doesn't have authority to investigate.
Yeah.
So for instance, we did a lot of work around sexual abuse by school personnel in schools.
Yeah.
The requirement there is that you have to call and report to DHS and wait for the DHS investigation, but you don't actually have the authority to investigate that because it's not family abuse. Child care, Dr. Richardson and I sat in a place where the reliance of them to do their licensing in child care is dependent on the report that comes out of Child Protective Services. But the question there is this child safe and in a protected place? So once that child leaves, somebody else goes into that slot, and without that ability for DHS to act or do a report, child care division is kind of stuck because they can't really take any action on a license, and then they will know somebody's going into a place that they know to be unsafe but can't take action. So that's whatever the structure is. I don't know what the answer is, but the problem, I think, is this gap where it's almost worse because people are reporting it, but that report goes into a place where nobody has authority to do anything with the report.
Chair Gelser, I think you're absolutely right, and it really is, I think, incumbent on us to get together with child care, with the Early Learning Council, with education, and, you know, with any other agency where there is overlap, to really kind of ferret out where those gaps are and figure out a way to close those gaps. And there are some gaps. You're absolutely right.
Senator Munns-Anderson.
Thank you. And I want to thank your staff, too, that have been taking the time to come talk to me. I see some sitting there about this issue, about a number of issues. But I have also been talking with providers in my district. And because I can relate to what they're saying, we are actually have put on more work for them to report. And having been a public health nurse and all the writings that I had to do on every home visit that I made, what they're finding, the providers, where it usually just took one person to report to the state, now one foster care, it takes three people, three different people. So that's adding to the cost, yet not sure that DHS is actually taking that into assessment, into consideration when the contracts are made up. And so from that standpoint, too, I think we need to be really open to how much burden we are putting on them, but making sure that we're compensating not just for the care, the types of care that they give, but also the administrative piece.
So, Senator Chair Gelser, Senator Monis Anderson, I couldn't agree with you more. Part of the things we wanted to kind of take a look at, there are a couple things in the area of licensing and investigation, and then I have a comment just overall, is number one, making sure that if we're asking somebody to do something, we have a really good reason, and if they're reporting, we're using that information, and the information is serving a purpose. And so we'll have to do some evaluation on what our reporting requirements are and some of our licensing requirements, because I want to try to make that as streamlined as possible. I don't want them in the office filling out paperwork. I want them on the floor working with clients and consumers. I think the second part on the investigation side, and part of it might be a resource issue, is we need to be more timely in completing our investigations, because when we do investigate someone, typically a facility has to put a person out on administrative leave, and that's a cost to them, and it's a cost they really can't afford. So we have to really work on being timely with our investigations. And the way I've been talking to staff about this is we really need to look at this as a system. You can't look at any part of the system in isolation. And the system consists not just of DHS, but it's foster parents, paid providers, adult foster homes. You know, it really is a system of care for the people we're charged to care for. And I would submit to you that if any part of the system fails or doesn't work, it jeopardizes the entire system. And so we really have to work hard to make sure, you know, two things. Number one, that these providers, foster parents, whoever, are getting the resources and the tools they need to do their job. And number two, that they're being held accountable for the safety of the people we care for. So I think that's kind of the way, when in talking to staff, the way I've been telling people we need to look at it. You can't look at any piece in isolation, because there's kind of a continuum of care. And if any part of that continuum is in jeopardy, I think you jeopardize the whole continuum.
And I would just add that I think one of the other important considerations is bringing all of those people together and meeting their needs, but also remembering that the core and the focus, the most important stakeholder in this whole process for child foster care is youth. And I don't know that as a state we've done a good job or have a good track record of actually listening to what the youth are telling us is happening to them, either on an individual basis or on a systemic basis. And part of that, I think we need to do a better job. And you and I together have met with kids that have asked for help from the system, and they've been ignored. We have to move beyond that and look at those lessons in other systems as well. In the DD system, nobody speaks for people with developmental disabilities except for people with developmental disabilities, not parents, not providers. That is what should drive it. In the senior system, it has to be about the people, their needs first, and we bring providers into the system that share those values and are willing to comply with regulations that keep them safe and honor their dignity and self-determination.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, I couldn't agree with you more. Although the reason the governor asked me to step into the role at DHS was because of issues around child safety. It's not just about child safety. It's about safety of all the people we care for. We care for some of the most vulnerable Oregonians in the state, and it's our responsibility. Two things, as far as I'm concerned. One, to make sure that they're safe, and to make sure that they have the opportunities and the kind of quality of life that we would want for ourselves. And that's got to be our goal, and that's what we have to drive to. And we have some work to do.
Thank you. Senator Dimbro.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Clyde, I really appreciate the systemic analysis that you're doing. And then, you know, looking forward, it sounds as if you'll have the personnel work, at least initially, in hand over the summer, at a point where perhaps by September ledge days you can, you know, share that with us. You know, following up on the chair's comment earlier, in terms of gaps in DHS's authority, you know, that suggests that you may need to come to us for some statutory changes. Mm-hmm. And so do you see that happening? Do you see yourself being in a position to do that in September as well, as we're trying to put our pre-session filing things yeah. together?
Chair Gelser and Senator Dembro, we are keeping a running list of where the gaps are. And so, yeah, we will be ready in September to come and say we really, either before the committee or individually or you know, in a number of different ways to kind of come and talk to you about some of the ways or some if we need legislation to close some of those gaps where that is.
I think that would be very timely if we could do that in September.
And I think putting those things out there, I know the process for a policy option package to move through and whittle down is challenging. I would hate for important things to be left on the table when we're here to help you put them in as committee bills or member bills, even if you can't move them forward as agency bills.
Yeah. So, Senator Gelser, thanks. We appreciate it. The one thing I will tell you that has been really gratifying, we have had a lot of support, not just from the governor, but from members of the legislature. I think yourself, Representative Stark, other members of this committee, and other legislators have really been very gracious in reaching out to us and saying, what can we do to help? And it's really kind of helped us make the progress and make the movement that we have so far. And so for that, I just wanted to express my appreciation.
Thank you. And then before we move on to the challenges, could you update us on the external review and the internal
Chair,
investigation?
Before we leave this subject, just a comment. When we're talking gaps, like mandatory reporter, no authority, you're in a mix of a lot of mandatory reporters. And I'd just be very sensitive to where the ultimate authority should lie. In some cases, it's at the local level, and you report to I mean, there needs to be a nexus there, obviously, but I would not suggest that DHS be the overall authority for all actions. A lot of it needs to be local. So just the sensitivity there.
Chair Gelser and Senator Cruz, appreciate the comment. And to be honest with you, I don't want to be the ultimate authority the decisions. I think decision-making should rest at the appropriate level. And I'm a big fan of pushing it down as far as it as you can. I don't feel like Dr. Richardson and I have a lot of free time to make those
calls. You don't
want
to start
calls.
Wearing badges.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Chair Gelser and members of the committee, just a quick update on the external assessment of substitute care and child welfare. So we started the assessment in March, and we're targeting August for completion. We've contracted with a company called Public Knowledge, who actually does a lot of work in Oregon and in other states. And I feel really comfortable with the people they've assigned to this project because they've had a lot of experience in child welfare issues in Oregon and in other states. So we have a 17-member external advisory committee, and Senator Gelser and Representative Stark are both members of that committee. The committee is comprised of legislators, providers, advocates, stakeholders. And the one piece of the committee that I found extremely valuable and have been very appreciative of, we actually have two youth who used to be foster kids, foster children, and have kind of aged out of the system now. And their, I think, input insight has been a very educational and eye-opening part of the process, at least for me, and have really appreciated their input. So right now we have completed phase one of the project in which we developed the scope and the methodology and also a set of guiding principles on the work that's going to be done. During that phase, our contractor conducted policy research and developed as-is system maps. They did mapping of the way we do business now. And they also reviewed federal state statutes, administrative rules, policies related to child welfare in Oregon. And so I think some of the work they did actually will be helpful in helping us identify some of the gaps that Chair Gelser and Senator Denbro talked about. And so we're currently in phase two of the project. In phase two, so far, the contractor has reviewed over 100 documents and reports related to Oregon child welfare. There are no number of task forces and committees that have issued reports on the state of child welfare in the state of Oregon. And we also had them review the current or recent Children and Family Services review, which we didn't fare too well in. And also they looked at litigation documents, which I think there's some very good information, valuable information that can be gleaned from that material, as well as legislative reports. They also conducted interviews of 15 key informants and held two focus groups. And as we speak, are drafting a list of 15 possible inquiry areas, or areas where we're really going to do the deep dive. And that they are going to share that with the advisory committee on Friday. And last time I talked to them, they are hoping to get them to the advisory committee by the end of the day today or first thing tomorrow morning. So you all will have a chance to review them before the meeting on Friday. And once we've prioritized the inquiry areas, then we'll move to phase three, which will be kind of the deep dive, the in-depth review analysis through focus groups and research and review of materials, review of case files and those types of things. And then again, targeting August for completion. And so that's where we are. Happy to answer any questions. Before I turn it over to Dr. Richardson, Chair Gelser, I knew you had some questions about the DD, I think, sustainability work and budget issues. I actually would like to bring Lily up to address those. We can do them now after Dr. Richardson, or actually she's going to be before you later to talk about employment first, and she can address them at that time, whatever your preference is.
So I think it would be good to separate it from employment first, since it's two different systems.
So with your indulgence, maybe I'll have Dr. Richardson go, and then when he's done, we'll bring Lily up to the table.
Sounds fun.
Okay, great.
Senator Gelser and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Reginald Richardson. I have the privilege of serving as the Deputy Director for DHS and also the Interim Child Welfare Director. I've been asked to talk about our challenges and opportunities. As you might imagine, within child welfare, we have quite a few challenges, which opens it up to have a number of opportunities to make real systemic change. And under the leadership of Director Psyche, one of the areas that he has focused his attention and our attention has been on safety, making sure that the children that we have responsibility for are safe in substitute care and in the homes in which we are asked to make some determination as to whether or not there have been sustained allegations of abuse or neglect. And that has been a focus not only in child welfare, but also across our agency. There are six other areas that I'd like to mention as challenges and opportunities for us. One is what you've already heard, and we sent information earlier this month to the Senate and the House in terms of our Federal Child and Family Services review. We're not surprised that we didn't do as well as we would have hoped. It gives us, again, a sort of roadmap to the areas that we need to provide additional support and work around. We have changed our internal processes for evaluation to ensure that we are hitting the mark in terms of what those 14 areas are asking for. It's a good roadmap to what the child welfare system ought to look like. And so we are endeavoring to make sure that we have a a plan that has the appropriate monitoring systems attached to them so that we can have an improvement plan that isn't just something that's on paper, but it's a living document that we are actually monitoring to make sure that we're making the systemic changes that we need to make within child welfare. You also received from me communications that we put a pause on our differential response work. I just have to say quite candidly that I need to be assured that we are doing the work necessary to make sure that the families, children and families are safe, receiving the services that they need to receive in order to make the changes that we ask them to make. We have heard, Director Psyche and I have heard consistently from our caseworkers that they are overwhelmed. We have seen from the reviews that they are having difficulty getting out and seeing families, both children and parents. And so we are concerned that the administrative burden on them may be too much. And so we are looking at that, pausing DR as a part of that process to make sure that we are giving staff the kind of resources they need in order to do the work that we've asked them to do. It is completely unfair to ask people to do things without preparing them or giving them the work, the resources in order to do the work that we've asked them to do. So in those areas that have already implemented DR, as we've said in our communication before, that work will continue. We are just putting on pause. For me, I have to be assured that we are able to get out and investigate, understand, and assess those families appropriately. And right now, I'm not convinced of that. And until that happens, we'll continue to pause. We've asked the group to look at whether or not we need to do retraining in those areas. And so we've got a bit of an assessment going on to make sure that we're going to implement the work as we promised. I don't suspect that the pause will be long, but it will be long enough for us to be confident that we could stand before folks and say that the work we're doing is good quality work. As you know, Senate Bill 1515, we've developed a work plan to implement the provisions of that piece of legislation, that law, and so we're working quickly to do that work. We've got a dedicated team that are working to make sure that the timelines are going to be met and that we understand what's being asked of us and that we are changing our practice to make sure that we're able to implement what's been asked of us in that legislation. The other area that actually was somewhat of a surprise to me, and we kind of discovered it together, is where we are with Carley's Law, and that we've asked by September 1st every child welfare staff person to be retrained to make sure that they understand the provisions of that, the requirements of that law. And that they have the resources in which to be able to do that as well. Again, we're a transmittal went out to all staff just this past last week. There's a video that Senator Gelser, you're very familiar with because you starred in that video that we're using as the training piece and making sure that workers and supervisors are discussing it, and we have a tracking system to make sure that all of our staff have gone over that training as well. In regards to making sure that we understand the burden that we're asking our workers to undertake in terms of the change in what the child welfare looks like today versus 5, 10, 15 years ago, the administrative work that we're asking, we're hearing that our workers are having a hard time because they're doing all the other things in terms of filing reports and sort of the paperwork of the job. We have asked for volunteers to join a work group for us to really dig into deeply, do analysis on what is the workload that we've asked our workers to engage in and whether it's realistic so that we can make the appropriate changes to ensure that they're out doing what we want them to do, which is to be in the homes, meeting with their kids and families and providing the services that we've asked them to do. The other area that I'll just reemphasize, and that is the analysis for both licensing and adult protective services. We are doing that work and getting close to making some recommendations of what that should look like and the additional comments that have made during the committee today. Those are the major areas. There are a number of areas that we could certainly focus on and should be focusing on, but as you know, if you get too many areas at one time, all you do is to get an inch deep and a mile wide, and we really don't want to do that. And in, particularly as the interim, I was advised to make sure that you can tackle a few number of things and really try to do those things well that are really going to get the greatest payoff for our system. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you both very much. And Dr. Richardson, I hope you don't stop answering the phone when Clyde calls to ask you to do things.
I didn't know it was an option. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you so much.
Senator, so at this point in time, I'd have Lilia come up. Okay. And
Lilia.
There she is.
I'm going to step back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lilia Tenenti. I'm the director of the Office of Developmental Disability Services in DHS. This last session, we were given, both APD and DD were instructed to look at options for addressing our budget sustainability issues. And the reason I'm been in discussions and the reasons where I wanted to talk to you today or we wanted to discuss today is one of the immediate actions that we're planning to take effective July 1st for the Office for DD Services Systems. One of the directives we were asked to look at was our service hours and how we're authorizing service hours and how that aligns with what people are using and what people may need. And what we've found is there is a significant, there's a gap between what we're authorizing and what people are actually utilizing. And so what we're looking at doing starting July 1st is really realigning our assessment and how many hours we're authorizing to bring it more in line with what we're seeing in terms of current trends. This is important because ultimately, as a result of this, everyone who receives in-home services, which includes day support activities and supported living services, will have an assessment that starts July 1st. Everyone currently in the system for a plan that starts September 1st that will ultimately will result in something different than they've had in the past. And so I wanted to notify and inform everyone that this is happening because I suspect that there will be individuals for whom this, they'll get the notification and they'll have access to information and why this is happening and an exceptions process and appeal rights. But since this is a change, we expect that there may be questions about it. And we're working very diligently with our partners, our family network groups, our CDPs and brokerages and other partners on communications plans. And we've begun developing materials that we'll be sharing widely with families as this gets underway. This is one step that we're taking to start to, as I would say, bend the cost curve. It's not the final answer for addressing the sustainability for the DD system in Oregon, but it's one step in that direction. And always when you take a step like this, whenever you try to bring things in after they've gone wide, it's a little bit challenging. And so I appreciated the opportunity to talk today and just make sure the committee members were aware of this. And if you had any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. We're also going to be presenting this information in the Joint Ways and Means E-Board Subcommittee hearing just a little bit later today.
And Lilia, just to clarify for when we get the communications, the experience that the vast majority of individuals with developmental disabilities will have isn't one of actual reduced service, of having less support. It's just more of a truing up of what that assessment spits out in terms of the number of hours and the number of hours people actually have demonstrated that they use across the state.
That is our goal, exactly. And what we expect will happen as a result is we've set up some exceptions processes, which we've already had, but we're making sure that we're going to be ready for when people have questions. And then everyone, of course, even if it doesn't affect the actual numbers they're utilizing, just having the authorization lowered will give people the ability to appeal if they decide and choose to do that. So it is something where everyone's going to find out about it because it'll affect authorizations for everyone. But ultimately, our goal is to, as I've described it, take some of the risk off the table, look at how we can more align what the hours of assessment are with what we're seeing people using. And we recognize that in some cases, our authorizations, what we're authorizing, have been higher than people need, but we also recognize in other cases, provider capacity may be an issue. And even in the time we've been talking about this with legislators and publicly with our partners and stakeholders, we are seeing kind of increases in utilization beyond what we saw when we first looked at this several months ago. So we're looking at how we can do this in such a way to honor the commitment I feel I've made, which is to take risk off the table, but do it in such a way that we're minimizing at this point impact to a large number of the people that we're supporting, which is a difficult balance if you think about it.
And then just to put kind of an anecdote on it, because our family goes through this assessment process. So you kind of go through, you answer a whole series of questions, the case manager types them in, and then the computer magically spits out a number, which is different than how it used to be in the past. You would talk about the individual, their family, their needs, and you would design a plan. So for our family, in the first year he had services, the number was this enormous number, and I don't think we even used half of the numbers. He just went through his reassessment, and based on his reassessment, he's now authorized for even more, I think like 20% more than what he was authorized for the prior year, even though he only used half. So it's, I think it's a really smart way to go at things, and the challenge will be helping families to understand that we're not taking services away, we're truing up the way that resources are allocated, which will make the system more sustainable and not have us budgeting dollars for something that doesn't actually exist, and that can paralyze the system and really hurts everybody inside the system.
So just for clarification, so what will be communicated to people will be what their utilization has been, their actual utilization, and then what their new authorization will be, and to kind of show that the two are coming closer together.
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro, ideally that would be what we would provide to individuals. I think at this point, though, I have to be honest in that our IT systems are somewhat of a challenge sometimes, and so I'm not at this point confident we're going to be able to do that for everyone. What we will be providing to people is information on what's happening, why it's happening, and then if we have the ability or people or if we have individuals or families who are very interested, I think we can we'll offer the ability to kind of share that information. We are looking at a way to do it on a systems-wide basis, but at this point, I've learned not to commit to things that rely heavily on our IT systems, and that's just a I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fair, as long as there's a kind of human touch component.
Definitely.
And then along those lines, how do you see the exceptions process working?
Another good question, Senator Dembro. The exceptions process, as it exists today and as it will ultimately expand, because we do expect more people to be going through it now with this, it really is, it's based on the needs of the individual. What I've asked the team that we have working on it to do is to put together specific criteria on if somebody comes through, for example, this is just one example, if we've been running the K plan now for a couple of years, so we have people who we've granted exceptions to in the past. And so if we've got someone who we've granted an exception to in the past, that should be a signal to us that this is probably someone who likely we would agree to do it again in the future, and so let's move that through on a more quickly, because what we don't want to happen is to come up with a system or a process for exceptions that creates a huge backlog while we've got people waiting to start their services. So our exceptions processes are based on the needs of the individual, look at what the assessment yields, look at the documentation of what they've used or needed in the past, and then pulls that together to say yes or no. And if they go through the exceptions process and we say no, then they still have all of the full appeal rights available to them to move that forward if they choose to do so.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Just a couple specifics, if you can, on the assessment itself. Which assessment are you using?
Okay.
Is it nationally recognized? And does it kind of revert back to at least a little bit some of the family supports and taking those into consideration?
Chair Gale, Sir Representative Stark, those are excellent questions, too. What we're doing in this step, I talk about this as kind of step one of what will be a longer step two, three, probably four, five process over the course of the next couple of years. This is still based on the adult needs assessment and the child needs assessment, which are tools that were developed by the Office of Developmental Disability Services during about a 4 to 6 week period when we were directed very clearly, get in line with all the regulations, do it fast, do it now. And so I do not publicly call this tool normed or validated or nationally recognized. It's one that was put together by a group of people working under an extreme environment. And so what we're seeing now, we have the tool, they put it together, we started using it, then we got our data system in place where we could look at both authorized and utilized hours, because when it first came out, we had all of the payment structures going through brokerages, so we had like 12 or 14 different entities doing payment and the state doing payment, and so we've been able to then, the next step was get it all into one system, so now we can do the step we're doing now, which is look at what we're authorizing statewide versus what people are actually using. But the next step for us going forward, we're in the process of developing what a valid tool. We've got a group of stakeholders working with us, as well as we did an RFP and have a Mission Analytics is the name of the company coming in to work with us on it. They've developed assessment tools in other states. We have a pilot that was planned to start in May. However, due to IT issues, we've had to delay the start of the pilot. Sensing a theme. We've had to delay the start of the pilot until we get the tool into something that all of our pilot counties can utilize, and we can collect the data and track it effectively. What our goal would be to have the pilot completed, finalize that assessment tool, it become the assessment tool that becomes the basis for not just in-home hours, but all of the services we provide. Because for those who may not be familiar with the DD system right now, we use a different assessment for different services that people go into. So it's very confusing and results in just a number of different things happening. So we're looking for one assessment that we can point to that we've worked hard to develop. That has face validity to it, and then what we would do from there is build our authorization processes. The next phase is building our authorization process off of that tool. So this is an interim step with the current tools we're using, recognizing that we'll be going to another assessment that we've put some effort into validating and developing, and then building new authorization levels off of that that will be more in line with what we're doing now, with the change we're making now, and also, quite frankly, more in line with whatever our budget might look like coming out of the next session.
Senator Montefiore.
Okay. Thank you for coming to Gresham. Also, Dr. Richardson and Jill Gray, thank you for coming to Gresham. I mean, this is an extremely important issue in my district, as it is across. And you had said, any emails that we get, we can direct to you. Well, this one came Saturday, so I haven't had a chance to get it to you. But it is parents that are very concerned about their, and I will be forwarding this email to you. But she wanted me to bring forth 11 questions and put that on the record. And rather than do that, I would like to email those questions mm-hmm. to staff and then to you so that we at least have it on record regarding her situation and her sheltered workshop and the fact that she feels that her child's job is being jeopardized with the new laws that are happening.
And Senator, we're going to come back to the sheltered workshop in a minute later. Right. So right now we're on the assessments, but she's going to go away and then
right.
she's going to come back.
You're going to come back.
Then
all right, I thought
about,
we were in
then
the
we're going to talk about
I didn't want to lose this. Okay.
We will not lose it, I promise.
Thank you.
Wait, but before you go, are there any other questions? No. Okay. Right. Thank you. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. I didn't realize that we were going to separate them out.
Yeah. two different funding streams, and it's contributing to the confusion. So next we're going to talk about leasing agreements. And so we have Eric Chambers, Kim Fredlin, Linda Riddell, and Shannon Ryan. Can we grab an extra chair so that we can have? Great. Thank you.
And Chair, while they're getting ready to come forward, we in this poverty is growing, I feel, exponentially in my district, and the needs are extremely high. And Eric Chambers from the city brought to my attention that we were losing one of the DHS's services that they provide in our community, and is being then moved to 6 miles away into Portland. It might be your district, I don't know, Senator Dembro. But a lot of us are very concerned that this is moving away, and we are hoping that it won't happen to any other services. It's our understanding that DHS leases everything, and then when they outgrow a space and need to move on, they work, I guess, with facilities as well as DHS to find a place. And so I want Eric to explain what happened to us, and then we want to understand the process so that there are places in East County that would be more accessible, even buildings that would be more accessible for our clients to receive their services. So, Eric, you go ahead, and then we'll see how this whole process works.
Before he gets started, this is not unique to Gresham.
Yes, I know. I heard that it happened in Senator Gelser's district.
It was DMV.
Oh, it was DMV. Okay.
Well, and in Roseburg as well. So.
Okay, all right.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As Senator Monis Anderson mentioned, my name is Eric Chambers, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the City of Gresham. Our City Council learned, actually from constituents, around mid-February that the Self-Sufficiency Center in currently located in downtown Gresham would be moved 6 miles west to around 118th and Gleason in Portland, so I think just outside of Senator Dembro's district. When they heard the news, you know, they discussed it as a council and asked me to reach out to Senator Monis Anderson, Representatives Peluso and Gorsuch, and just ask them to look into the issues, see what we could learn, what we could find out, and kind of what goes into the decision-making process for those types of moves. I want to thank Senator Monis Anderson for her leadership on this issue. I know that it's very important to her, and deeply appreciate her commitment and support. As Senator Monis Anderson mentioned, the flow of poverty in the Portland metropolitan region has kind of had a steady drumbeat to the east. In the past 20 years, we've seen around an 11% decrease in median family income, that's CPI adjusted. Concurrently, we've seen about a 10% increase in families that are at or below the poverty line. So definitely, we've seen census data routinely point at need coming east as areas of inner Portland redevelop and those gentrifying forces move that poverty east. So a lot of concern around what services are available for our residents and what the service needs look like as that that condition continues. The Self-Sufficiency Center in Gresham, just for context, it provides supplementary nutrition assistance benefits, SNAP, and TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Many of those families are double counted there in terms of receiving both benefits, but there's around 900 households that are affected by those service needs. By definition, these are households who are probably pretty transportation challenged or reliant on public transportation to be able to get to those areas for services. Their current location is very near the MAX line, which I'm sure is convenient for many, and definitely a lot of concern around making sure that there's services available for our residents, our constituents who are in need. after once the council brought this to our legislative delegation's attention, the Department of Human Services folks, I want to compliment Dr. Richardson. I know there were some personnel changes that were kind of overlapping in that process, but Dr. Richardson was very responsive, came out, met with us, and brought his whole team along as well, and we really appreciate their interest in trying to make sure that these types of issues get the attention they need, the local connection and partnerships that they deserve. At this point, you know, our concern is, of course, making sure that any mitigating factors that are available to provide those services for our residents are implemented. If there's opportunities to provide the services remotely, I think that the phrase the agency used was hoteling of services, but whatever that looks like in terms of trying to make sure that people are either able to get the access to transportation to the services that they need or that the services are provided in some way in Gresham. I think it probably an overarching concern, too, and one that might be of interest to the committee, is that there's also one of the silver linings of this process is that we learned that the Early Childhood Center, also in Gresham, that the lease is due on that coming up in 2017. And so as we approach that lease expiration, I think anything that we can do to work with the agency to ensure that we look heavily at opportunities in Gresham to keep those services in the community, and if possible, potentially to bring some of the self-sufficiency services back out by co-locating them as part of that agreement. So that's just something that we'd like to keep on the radar. Again, appreciate the agency's responsiveness and interest in finding a solution to this, and definitely want to make sure that we have those services available for our residents. You know, we are working very hard to provide services in place, but that movement of poverty to the east is something that's probably going to be around for a while, and so we want to make sure that we're being responsive to that. Thank you.
So what we really want to know is what is the process of how you locate a site?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Kim Fredland. I'm the self-sufficiency director for the Department of Human Services.
And good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Linda Riddle. I am the administrator for the Office of Facilities Management for DHS and OHA.
And Senator Gelser, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Shannon Ryan, administrator for the Enterprise Asset Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services.
So this morning we are going to present an overview of the DHS facilities leasing process, which includes the process that we use through DAS. And we're going to talk about changes that we made recently due to the concerns that came out of the community in Gresham as the office was being relocated in Gresham.
Okay, with that, Senator Gelser, members of the committee, I'd like to explain a little bit about DAS's overarching role as that pertains to leasing in the real estate, private real estate market, as well as some detail around that actual process. So I'll start with DAS's overall role. From a macro level, DAS manages the state's leasehold portfolio, which consists of about 4.1 million square feet statewide. We establish and manage the state's policies and approaches to commercial leasing, and then provide brokerage representation to our client agencies in those transactions. So how that translates to service delivery for our client agencies is that we help them with the full lifecycle transaction management, from needs assessment and planning assistance, market research, site search. We do political outreach and notification to municipalities, counties, legislators, as well as community outreach to stakeholders on the ground. We negotiate the lease terms to our properties, execute the lease agreement, and when it is deemed optimal to the state's interests, we do loop in third-party brokers. So the overall benefit for the client agencies and the enterprise as a whole is that DAS retains the in-house industry expertise that enables us to navigate the complexities of the private real estate market while still upholding the public policies and procedures. So that's kind of a broad overview of DAS's role and how we approach that obligation. So the leasing process itself is really just four phases. We receive a notification and a business case from our client agency, in this case DHS, around the need to relocate or expand. From that, we start phase one, and that's just planning. And we work with the client agency closely to refine scope and need, functionality, location, square footage, and really overall strategic objectives of any given transaction. From there, we go to phase two. And phase two is we engage. We engage the market and we engage the community. So engaging the market means we canvas for potential properties like any other broker would, select sites to tour and tour the agency. Simultaneous to that, and sometimes actually even preceding that action, we reach out to communities, especially in the smaller rural areas where movement, our movement, is of paramount importance to the community. And so it is incumbent upon us to position ourselves to bolster economic development whenever possible. From there, we go to stage three. We negotiate the lease terms based on what we found in the market for potential properties, and then we move to draft and execute the lease agreement. At that point, we hand it off to the client agency for subsequent lease administration. And that's a broad overview of the process that DHS follows, as well as all of our client agencies. Do you have any questions?
Yes.
I might answer.
So in our case, when I was talking to, I'd say, three different realtors, they weren't aware of this process. So how does DAS communicate with the real estate in East County? Because you probably have some people that you always go to, and I'm just wondering, how can we include people from East County and educate them on the needs? How can they get onto your portfolio or whatever it is that you have?
Okay, that's a great question. Senator Gelser, Senator Montes-Anderson, we, in your particular case in Gresham, and oftentimes in a lot of transactions in the Portland metro area, we do use third-party brokers, and we rely on their network of other brokers to get the word out, as it were. So that is certainly one angle. Another angle is to be part of our list, I guess, for lack of a better word. We issue requests for information. These are formal requests that we launch far and wide to developers, real estate brokers, landowners. Any interested party can be on that list to notify them when the state is on the move to expand or otherwise relocate. So that is certainly a way to go about it as well. The DAS Real Estate website will list all of our larger lease transactions. DHS is always in that category just due to their size. Anything 10,000 square feet and over is listed on our website as well. So that's another option. What's interesting is DAS used to approach leasing in the private sector much like a public procurement. We've recently, over the last year and a half, changed the rules, the administrative rules, to enable DAS to move. We always say move about the cabin freely, and that's engage the market like any other real estate broker would. And so I guess the downside of that is it is not as public as it was prior to the rule change. And we've been talking with DHS and us and realized that, especially given the situation, that maybe that's a blind spot for us, and would like to get your thoughts around how we might be more forthcoming.
So you said in this case you went to a third-party broker, and you probably use the same third-party broker. I don't even know who that third-party broker would, but they probably already have a client list and know a certain area. And we need to educate them to start including more of East County. I just don't know the process on how to do that education.
Senator Gelser, Senator Montes-Anderson, yes, we do use one of two brokers of record. We use Cushman & Wakefield as well as Jones Lang LaSalle. In your case, we were using Cushman & Wakefield. And I think part of the engagement for the Gresham transaction was driven largely in part by DHS's physical facility need. There are only so many places we can site such a very, very large user. And so our brokers pursued buildings versus, I think, relationships in this particular case. But again, that said, we are more than happy to engage any real estate broker or realtor in your area, and certainly just have a conversation about what our process is and how to get involved with it early on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think there is a meeting with at least one person with coming up who actually has buildings, I believe. So sure. Be aware of that.
Senator Cruz. Okay.
Is DHS unique in the construct of kind of design build from other agencies? Because that's happening in Roseburg as well. They're building a new building because one-stop shopping and the old DHS building, which was built to their specs, no longer fits their need, which leaves somebody owning a piece of property with a building on it that doesn't work for anybody else. Mm-hmm. So, but is DHS relatively unique in that aspect?
Yes, that's a great question, Senator Gelser, Senator Cruz. Yes, DHS has very specific facility needs, and I'll let DHS facilities speak to that. But tangentially, certainly from our standpoint, when we're negotiating a transaction, there is extensive build-out very specific to DHS, depending on which program is to be housed. But there are heightened security concerns. There are more private rooms, meeting rooms, cleanup rooms, so on and so forth, again, depending on the intended use for DHS. And so to your point, yes, in Roseburg, DHS is migrating, and again, I'll let DHS speak to this, but migrating to a more one-stop shop sort of mega service center.
About a mile down the road, so it's all,
yeah. Right, just a ways down the road. And it's happening in several communities, and it's, to DHS's credit, it is a way for them to, you know, congregate their services so everybody can just come and you do food stamps and, you know, grandma and grandpa can be there and everything, soup to nuts. From DAS's perspective, we are very sensitive to the big vacant, you know, ghost buildings, if you will, that we leave on the landscape, and particularly, again, in the smaller and rural communities. And as we look across our portfolio and other agencies that are on the move, we look to those vacated buildings first, those assets that we could rehab and repopulate. We also work closely, especially in your region, with the governor's regional solutions teams in canvassing not just state agencies, but also maybe partnerships with communities, you know, local nonprofits, and anything to get those assets filled.
Madam Chair, I would almost assume that in the case of DHS, as we go to the one-stop shopping, the cheapest solution is new build rather than try to take some old building and rehab it into something that would fit the need. So,
but DHS doesn't own their buildings, correct?
No.
Yeah, right.
But to meet their need, you know, you basically got to start from the first stick, I think, to get the sort of structures they need.
Senator Dimbrough.
Yeah, and maybe we'll get to this when we get to the DHS piece. But I'm just wondering, so at what point does, you know, the agency make those decisions about, you know, maybe where it wants to locate, or, you know, what the nature is going to be, you know, if it's going to be a comprehensive facility, you know, it's how this particular decision fits into the larger agenda of what they're trying to achieve. Is that, like, right at the beginning of this process? How does that fit in?
That's a great question. Senator Gelser, Senator Dimbrough. DHS's parameters are fairly thought through, if not entirely thought through, in terms of the need and the use and the location before it gets to DAS. It's part of DHS's internal due diligence and inclusive in the business case that they submit to us prior to a leasing action. So to your point, we take direction from DHS and its programs in terms of the need and the location. DAS's role is to carry out those wishes for our client agency with an overlay of sensitivity to community development, public policies and procedures that the state is obliged to follow, as well as local community development, depending on where we are and if it's possible.
And I would also suggest one-stop shopping has been driven by this body to DHS as well. So,
thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Yes, you want to talk about DHS?
Yes, please.
Let's talk about DHS.
We love to talk about DHS.
Oh, I bet you do.
We're the one-stop shop.
We are the one-stop shop for DHS discussion.
Our office, the Office of Facilities Management, manages the 180 building portfolio for DHS and OHA, and that's almost 3 million square feet of building space. And our responsibilities include lease management, telecommunications, janitorial service contracts, modifying workspaces to meet changing operational needs, and the coordination of construction and remodeling projects. And then slide three. DHS does, as Shannon talked about, work with DAS when leasing, relocating, expanding, or consolidating buildings. They provide the brokerage expertise and coordination for DHS real estate transactions. Prior to submitting a request to DAS to consolidate or relocate buildings, DHS develops a business case and cost-benefit analysis for the request. The business case is then reviewed internally by the DHS Facilities Advisory Committee for approval. Criteria that is used in considering that move is health and safety concerns for the current location, the service delivery drivers, which might mean that we've outgrown the space that we're in, transportation, public transportation accessibility, collaborations with community partners, local and state government, and budget neutrality. Additionally, after recent review of our process, DH has added a new step early in the process of informing and getting a go, no-go decision from the agency's executive leadership team. This is to ensure that the top leadership in DHS is aware of the move and the plan for engaging stakeholders. At the completion of these reviews, the request is submitted to DAS Leasing for processing, and Shannon spoke to that process from there. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that slide or the one just before it, that one, if you have any.
Well, just that I would hope that next time, it sounds like you're talking about, but next time around, that you start looking at where the poverty is actually moving to and it is located, and somehow we have fallen down in East Multnomah County into making sure that the buildings are on a portfolio, like with Cushman and Wakefield, et cetera. So are those the types of things that we need to do, or is there something that you can do as an agency to help locate it where the greatest need is?
Chair Gelser, Senator Moniz-Anderson, Shannon spoke a little bit to that we're currently reviewing the process of distributing information and gathering information from available buildings. Typically what is done is from the business case, let's say we're going out for a 35,000 square foot building, what we ask, the approach that we take is we work with the programs to develop the locational parameters, north, south, east, and west to locate that building so that it's within the caseload or the where our clients are, the client base. And then I notify DAS and say, these are our locational parameters. What have you got? Or can you work with the brokers to find out what buildings are 35,000 square feet or more? And so we kind of take more of the approach of searching for the building based on our client service needs in a community. And it sounds like there are things that we can do. I mean, I believe there are things we can do to maybe expand that process and maybe be more inclusive or a little bit different approach so that we're getting more information. And, you know, just including the community more than we have.
Well,
I'm just wondering, you know, if you look at the very first item there,
yes,
the need for relocation, consolidation, or expansion. In this case, and I don't know if we're going to be hearing that next, what were the desired objectives here? Because, you know, I do want to say with all due respect to my dear colleague, there has been a lot of growth in poverty in that area that we would call the Mid-County, you know, from about 92nd Avenue to 145th, or, you know, that area in there has seen a lot of the moves from Portland itself are moving into that Mid-County. And, you know, was that something that was taken into account as well?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro, when what started all of this process was really that we were being asked to leave one of the other facilities in Multnomah County. We've had a really challenging situation with the real estate market up there that we are being not the lease is not being extended for a few of our buildings, and so in the process of looking for a large facility to accommodate the office that was needing to move, there was this opportunity to combine a couple of offices, and that's what happened here in this particular case. So Gresham was not the location that was immediately the area that we were looking at. It was actually a different office. And so, it's really that real estate market in Multnomah County that has been a real challenge for us. We did look at the caseload, the amount of folks in poverty in the different areas. We looked at things like transportation connections and things like that. And while not ideal, it did meet, you know, those needs as we looked at this particular facility, the new site.
Okay, so just to follow up, so the capacity in the Gresham office was needed in this other location to make it pencil out for the moves to consolidate to a larger space?
Senator Gelser, Senator Dembro, yes, the because we were needing a large facility already, this particular facility was located that had space to accommodate the Gresham site as well, which for us would, you know, help with operations and budget issues and being able to get the office that was needing a new home into a space.
Anything further?
So we want to, the next location, we want to be located in Gresham, bigger one-stop shop.
Yes. Okay.
And just to follow up, and following up on Senator Mona Sanders' question, I think, to what extent is the impact on the facility that's going to be moved taken into account? I mean, how is that sort of factored in, you know, in terms of, so how far will these people have to travel to get to this new place? Mm-hmm. How disruptive will that be? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, is that something that would be taken into account at the very beginning of the process again? And how was that done here?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro, yes, that's for DHS, that's always the first thought that we have when thinking about moving to a new location is, can our customers get there? You know, how is there public transportation that is, you know, easy to access? Is there, will it create a hardship? What does that look like? And so, yes, that's always one of our first concerns. I will say the other issue here is that, you know, as we're looking at the needs of tomorrow, which I will get into a little bit, you know, we have a few options here. One is we certainly do a lot of online applications in the Portland metropolitan area already. And so that's something that we know customers can access us that way. We also are going to house some staff. We have a child welfare office in Gresham that we're going to house some staff there to provide some services. And we're also looking at housing our employment and training services at the WorkSource Oregon One Stop in Gresham so that we can continue to provide those services to the folks in Gresham.
And then finally, the site that's having to move because it's lost its lease, where is that and is it in my district?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dimbro, the DHS office that needs to move is located at,
122nd.
There we go. Linda's got the best answer here.
And
the
cross street.
Pardon me?
Sorry. 122nd and what? Not to be too self-centered here.
You're talking to somebody who lives in Dallas.
You need a city like ours.
Is it north, northeast or south? Is it
southeast? 122nd.
So maybe yours. No, it's not yours.
Not okay. Yours.
It's fine. Proceed.
So is there a place where members of the legislature, members of the public can look up online active leases and I'm trying to think of the word expiration. Expiration dates?
I would be happy to provide those for you.
And then we could see by district if there's something to pay attention to.
Chair, yeah, I had heard that there were three buildings in Washington County that you were trying to lease and they got bought out by a big corporation. And so I think, you know, Washington County has a huge problem.
And we have about 5 minutes left for this agenda item, and I want to make sure we get to what you have prepared.
Linda, do you want to talk about stakeholders really quick?
Sure. Slide 4. DAS is actually responsible for the standard distribution of public notifications and through their website, through notifications that are mailed out to members of the legislature, and then briefings with the governor's regional solutions team. And those are the things that were, those notifications and that process, as Shannon mentioned, we are taking a look at and doing some analysis on ways to maybe expand and improve that process.
So in addition to the standard communication steps, we've been, since this experience, we've been talking with program leaders about really making sure that we connect with not only customers that we typically engage with when we're moving, but also community leaders and partners in a much different way. And so the mantra that we've been talking about is early and often, you know, make sure that we're updating and communicating so that it's not a surprise. We, you know, feel badly that this was a surprise to the Gresham community leaders. We don't want that to happen again. I think the thing that I would just go through really quickly is that, you know, leases are a long-term commitment for us in DHS, and we really have to be thinking about not only the needs of today, but the needs of tomorrow. And I mentioned earlier that, you know, when we think about the needs of tomorrow, we are engaging in an IT solution that will enhance the capability of online applications for us. We currently, in one one of our programs, the SNAP program, which was mentioned earlier, we already receive about 50% of the total applications come in online. We see that increasing as the population ages and as our technology capabilities increase as we add the other programs that we administer to online services. We also do a lot of phone interviews, so there is a lot of ability now for folks to connect with us virtually and get the services that they need. We also are really engaged in, as I mentioned earlier, the workforce system and really making sure that our employment and training services, which are more face-to-face services, are being offered out of the WorkSource or, again, one-stop centers. So we have the capability of connecting with folks differently. We know that we will always need to have face-to-face services for folks who need that service or who want that service face-to-face, but we also know the demand is growing for those virtual services. And so how we see that emerging in the future is that we believe that we will have more community-based offices where those face-to-face services can be delivered, but also be able to give us the ability to have more call center type offices where virtual services can be delivered, and that, you know, real estate challenge of having those in high-priced, you know, metropolitan areas won't be as critical because we'll have smaller face-to-face services. So I think that wraps up the comments that we had. Do you guys have any questions before we
Any end? Brief questions before we move
just,
on?
Just a comment. You know, the new facility in Roseburg, which is under construction currently, mm-hmm. is a very positive move on virtually every level I could think of, including access by the customers. So it's just, you know, it's not always bad. So I just thought I'd point that out. So
thank you, Senator Cruz. Also, that Roseburg location, we are remodeling mm-hmm. a abandoned hospital. And expanding.
It was Douglas Community Hospital. The new part, which was basically offices, mm-hmm. Was the only part of the hospital that was left. And so you are, not only is it access the freeway very, very convenient for a lot of the people, South County, North County, and all of that sort of stuff, but it does take care of a very blighted part of the community. So it's a good move.
Right. Thank you all very, very much. Really Thank appreciate you. It. So we will close our informational hearing on leasing agreements, and we will come back to the Employment First update. And we have Lilia's coming back, and then Trina Lee and Acacia McGuire Anderson.
I can go here. You can click, but why don't you sit in the middle?
Welcome back.
For the record, again, my name is Lilia Tennessee. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services.
My name is Acacia McGuire Anderson. I'm the Interim Employment First Coordinator.
Good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Trina Lee, and I'm the director for Vocational Rehabilitation in the Department of Human Services.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, we just have a brief presentation today. A few things we're hoping to go over because we've had a lot of questions are the history of Employment First in Oregon, the Lane versus Brown settlement, which was formerly Lane versus Kitzhopper, federal policies impacting Oregon, sheltered workshops in Oregon, employment services, and the future of employment services for DHS. As many of you may be aware, Employment First started in the state of Oregon in 2008. It was started by self-advocates as well as the DD Coalition. It was transferred to the Office of Developmental Disability Services because it primarily affected people who had intellectual and developmental disabilities in 2009. In 2012, the Lane versus Kitzhopper, now Lane versus Brown, lawsuit was filed with 8 named plaintiffs, and that was significant in the sense that it encouraged Oregon to make sure that we codified our Employment First statute our Employment First policy in statute, as well as formally having Executive Order 1304, which was amended in 2015 to be Executive Order 1501. And as Lilia will talk about, we had the Lane versus Brown settlement agreement in January of 2016.
For those who may not be aware, this was Lane versus Brown was kind of one of the first of its kind when filed, and ultimately what this lawsuit settlement or what this lawsuit suggested was that Oregon was violating the Olmstead or Americans with Disabilities Act rights of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities by not supporting or allowing them to effectively transition out of sheltered workshops or access integrated employment opportunities. Since it was filed in Oregon, other similar lawsuits were filed in Rhode Island. Rhode Island settled with the U.S. Department of Justice in 2014, well before we settled, because we took a very we took the stance that we didn't agree that we were violating the settlement, violating Olmstead, and were preparing a defense ultimately in this lawsuit. Plaintiffs were, it was the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division that joined the suit, specific to children who are in transition age youth. And after a lengthy series of negotiations, we actually, the state, sat down and attempted negotiations with the plaintiffs, if I recall correctly, on three different occasions over the course of the life of the lawsuit. It wasn't until the last attempt was made under the guidance, mediation of a very skilled federal judge, that we were able to reach agreement and develop a settlement agreement that, from our perspective, honored the commitment the state had made to Employment First in the executive orders, but didn't raise the expectations beyond what we knew as a state or a system we would be able to achieve. Many of the actions in the settlement agreement are, if you look at it, it takes the Employment First executive order and puts it in the settlement agreement. Many of those actions the state was already engaged in, and we continue to work on those efforts and make progress in those areas. Something that happened over the time period of when the Lane versus, at that point, Kitzhaber or Lobb suit was filed, is that the federal landscape has shifted quite a bit in this area just in the last few years, specific to sheltered workshops and the rights of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities to access integrated employment services. One of the biggest changes that I think, from my perspective, really in some ways overshadows the settlement agreement is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which provides a federal match for all of the services that we provide under the Medicaid program, issued new home community-based settings rules that call for employment services to be provided in the most integrated setting possible. It defines segregated services as pre-vocational and time-limited. It also requires states to develop a transition plan on how they're going to implement these regulations. And if states still have settings that don't meet their expectations by March of 2019, now is the marker. It was 5 years from the day they issued the regulations. That's now March of 2019. Then federal funding for those settings is not going to be available through CMS. ODDS, OHA, APD and mental health system are all actively engaged in development and processing a global transition plan. Part of that plan, a big part of that plan, focuses on employment services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and is specific to sheltered workshops. This is kind of a big driver for us, going further even than I would say than the Lane settlement agreement, and it's something that we're very focused on right now as we move forward. Another change or a push in this direction in the federal landscape, it relates to the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act.
Good morning again. My name is Trina Lee from Vocational Rehabilitation, and I just wanted to give the committee a chance to really get a little bit more familiar with the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, or WIOA. And the focus of WIOA has definitely additionally set the landscape beyond the Lane versus Brown, where there's a priority, as the slide says, on integrated employment for all people with disabilities. Additionally, there is an increasing emphasis upon the services for transition age youth, the pre-employment transition services, of which the federal government has said to us, RSA has said to vocational rehabilitation, your grant that we're going to give you each year, 15% of that grant must be spent upon youth in school for the pre-employment transition services. They didn't increase the amount of the funding that we've given because we have a capped grant. But just to give you a really quick brush of the pre-employment transition services, there's five different categories: job exploration, counseling, work-based learning opportunities, counseling on post-secondary educational opportunities, workplace readiness training, and instruction in self-advocacy. Additionally, WIOA required, and I believe the last time I came to this committee, we talked a little bit about our shift in our service delivery system, where once a person has been determined eligible for vocational rehabilitation, in the past we had 180 days to get a person into plan, and since 2015 we had to cut that into half to where we have only 90 days to get a person into plan. Now, that doesn't mean 90 days a person will necessarily have a job. It depends upon the plan and the barriers and the services that that individual has. Additionally, we are required to work really closely with our workforce partners, which you heard Kim Fredland, the Director for Self-Sufficiency, mention earlier about the one-stop centers. We are also at the table working very closely with our employment partners to ensure that all individuals with disabilities are going to be able to seek and obtain the same services as all other Oregonians seeking employment service. So we have a long way to go, but we want to make sure that we're not duplicating services, that we definitely work within our wheelhouse and our areas of expertise. And recently, it was a little bit over a month ago now, the state of Oregon submitted our unified state plan to our federal partners, of which I had recently learned that all states and territories turned in the information on time, which was pretty monumental across the nation. We are now working with our federal partners because even though we put in a unified plan, different partners like the Rehab Service Agency approves our portion. So we put the one plan in and then it was split apart into the different agencies. And we've been having back and forth conversation and pretty much have landed upon our goals and objectives for the next several years, which we're pretty excited about. And then now it'll be time for us to really focus upon implementing those things. So let me pause really quickly before we move on to see if there's any questions about the federal landscape before I turn it back over to Lilia.
Senator Cruz.
Hopefully I have this wrong. Clearly I have no problem with mainstreaming as many people as possible, but sheltered workshops, some of the people, like at Sunrise in Roseburg, there's a community there, and some of those people, that is the top of their skill level. Are the feds kind of ignoring the status quo in that sort of area and assuming everybody can go wherever?
Thank you for the question, Chair Gelser and Senator Cruz. Basically, the emphasis upon integrated employment and integrated settings, and so it really is focusing upon the individual and what that individual needs to be able to be successful in that setting. The mantra is very much that if a person chooses, the choice is still there. If the person chooses to be employed, we're going to do everything in our power to be able to assist that individual with job coaching, job development, to be able to be as successful as possible in an integrated setting. Now, that may be a future goal, and it may take several non-integrated type of a settings, as in a sheltered workshop, to gain those skills, to be able to bring up the confidence level, those kind of things. We also have job coaches and job developers that are working on carving out jobs, working within the employers to determine exactly what their needs are, and then trying to determine and match up individuals with a specific skill set that would assist that employer. So I don't believe that, in my personal opinion, that the federal government is overlooking the need of every single person has to go to work. It's the ability of putting the supports in place. So if an individual chooses to do that, then we're certainly going to be there to help them. Does that answer the question?
It does. I guess my
and I'd like to give Lilia a chance to respond to that,
sure,
too.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and Senator Cruz. I think this is one of the questions that we get asked quite a bit. We've met with many individuals and families who have individuals who work in sheltered workshop settings. I think one of the interesting things that I've noted in this discussion is that the people who are in sheltered workshops are doing a job right now. They are working, and the issue isn't whether or not to some extent they can work. It's finding the right match for them and the right supports to help them identify the job that they would like. We have a service called Discovery that really focuses on what job is it that you would like to have in the community. And then, as Trina mentioned, we have things like job coaches and job developers who go find the jobs and then provide the support for the person while they're there. I think one of the interesting things about sheltered workshops is that when they were started, they were initially established as training centers, where the idea would be that a person would come there, would learn a skill, and then would move on to an integrated job in the community. What happened over time is often what happens is people went into sheltered workshops, and then that became the end game. There was no then movement out. And so I think for a lot of reasons, that's why the focus has come on sheltered workshops, is because they were intended to be short-term training places for people to go and work and integrated in the community. So without that happening, we just kind of created an environment where that's all that people did. And from our perspective, acknowledging the fact that there are definitely people in sheltered workshops and who are maybe transitioning out of schools that are going to need a lot of support to get to work. There's no doubt about that. But we want to make sure that those options are there, the support is there, and the person has the ability to get the integrated job in the community rather than starting from a position of assuming that it won't work for them. If we do everything we can to get them to a point where they can work in the community and, you know, we invest efforts and resources in that, our goal is that they be successful in that. So it's a difficult question about, you know, what the federal government thinks. I think that I don't want to go there, but I think that we definitely know that we need to do better, and we are doing better, and we're working to do even better than that in helping people currently in sheltered workshops, but also those transitioning from school and those in our other areas of our service system, to identify the kinds of jobs they want and get them the support to help them achieve those goals.
So, Lilia, would it be accurate to say that with the Employment First Initiative, the new rules, that the funding stream for employment will be focused on employment outcomes that demonstrate real work in the community at competitive wages, and that when people are going to sheltered workshops and they are engaging in community or socialization or other activities that are not leading to gainful employment, that would then shift to a different service system. Can you talk about the other supports that Sure. are surrounding people? If you can't work in the community, does that mean you're going to sit home alone and watch TV all day?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. That is a question that we get quite a bit from families and individuals that are very concerned about what's going to happen. I think because over time, sheltered workshops have gotten to a point in some instances where it is the main service that the person accesses during the day. They go there in the morning, they leave in the afternoon. That's what their week entails. There's a concern that if we're transforming sheltered workshops and moving into integrated employment, that these folks are going to be sitting at home. And that's absolutely not what we want and what we're working very hard to ensure doesn't happen. We have a number of different services specific to employment even. We have something called Employment Path Community, where people can learn, go out in the community and learn about jobs in the community. We have day support activities, which are also just day activities that may not focus on employment specifically, but a lot of our providers of sheltered workshop also provide day support activities, and so we're looking at how we can grow that service or help people understand that that's an option for them as well. And then, of course, in Oregon with the K-Plan, we have our one-to-one ADL, what we call ADL or IADL service, that's an option for some folks as well. So there are a number of different services, and I'm sure I'm not getting to them all. Aha, there they are. We'll get to those in just a second. So the goal ultimately is that we don't end up with people sitting at home without being able to access the community and do the things that they want. That would be an exact, that would be the opposite of what we want to achieve. The reality is that it's going to take a lot of work from our partners, our CDDPs and our brokerages, our provider agencies who are engaged in transformation. It's going to take a lot of work on all of our parts to make sure that we can develop for each individual person a plan for them that encompasses integrated work, that encompasses accessing the community to do other types of things, that really builds on their strengths and helps them become valued and continue to be and become ultimately valued members of their community.
Madam Chair, I point out, especially in Southern Oregon, a lot of the communities where we currently have 20% unemployment, opportunities aren't all that robust to start with. So trying to set up a timeline may be slightly difficult.
Mm-hmm. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I'm wondering, and I'll explain the statement, if we are bracing ourselves for the full circle implications of this. And what I mean, so if you think back historically, we have in the 70s a much-needed push that for kind of pushed Congress to act and say, look, we need to make sure we're not discriminating against those with disabilities. And hence, we start integrating into the community, integrating into the workplace, and ultimately sheltered workshops. Now we're saying, now comes along a lawsuit that says sheltered workshops are discriminating. And now, based off of emails that my office and others are receiving, that I'm fearing it for a small segment, and I'm pleased with the employment first. I want to see people integrated, so don't get me wrong here. But the small segment, I have examples sitting in front of me in my email right now that I think you've already seen, of individuals saying, look, our hours are already being cut back. I want to go out and do gainful employment where I feel like I'm actually working. I don't want to just do fun activities. I was working, now I'm not. My hours being cut back. Another family saying, "Look, they're saying that we'll have that our child or our adult that we're working with will always need one-to-one supervision, and that service is only going to last for a little bit, and then we'll have to provide that ourselves. We won't be able to provide that." And so I'm wondering if we're setting ourselves up for another lawsuit to come along and say, "Well, for this segment, now we are discriminating because without the sheltered workshop, which was designed in a way to meet that need, and we're not being able to integrate this really high need, how are we setting ourselves up to deal with that?"
Sure.
Let's let Lillian. Sure. Thank you. Sure. Representative Stark. I think, first off, I would say, as we talked to Senator Mona Sanderson, if you have emails from constituents and you want answers and want us to help respond, we're glad to do that. I think in the context of this discussion, we've met with a very vocal group of parents who are advocating strongly for their adult children. And I think that that's one group we've met with. We've talked to many others. I think from that perspective, there's an idea in talking to that group, and I don't know if it's exactly who's emailing you, but I'm going to say, in talking to that group, one of the discussion points we had was around the concept of Olmstead. And there was some frustration that sheltered workshops had been determined to be institutional settings. And, we kind of walked through the history of that happened because of the Oregon lawsuit and a federal judge ruling saying that the ADA and Olmstead apply to employment settings and apply to sheltered workshops. And so as part of that discussion, we talked about the opportunities for their children, their adult children, who we also met with and had good discussions with in the same meeting, about employment opportunities. I think when you think about this from the perspective of the supports we provide and what we do to help people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, the highest outcome we have is that they become integrated and members and valued members of their communities. I think if we're not pushing toward that, as you've indicated with employment, then we're not doing the right thing. I think the challenge here, we're at a critical moment in the history of Oregon, and frankly, the history, as you've heard from the federal landscape, every state that has relied on sheltered workshops is dealing with this exact same issue. We just ultimately, I would say, happen to be a little bit ahead of the curve than some states. Ohio just had a very similar lawsuit filed just a few months ago, and so they're going to be working through these issues as well. The benefit we have is we're a little bit ahead of the curve, and we recognize in Oregon, we have recognized that institutional residential settings are not something we want for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. That was a decision, a philosophy, a policy made by this state many years ago, well before any other state had moved in that direction. Oregon is now, more states are joining Oregon now in not having either public or private institutional settings for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. What that means is that we've accepted as Oregonians the fact that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities can and should live with us in our communities. The next step in that is accepting and recognizing and supporting the ability of those individuals to also then work with us in our jobs and in our places of employment in non-segregated settings. So it's not, I'm not suggesting it's easy. I'm not suggesting there's an easy answer. But it when I look at kind of the arc of the history of DD services, especially in Oregon, I think this is absolutely in line with everything we've done. And we can learn from what we did in the past. We can build on it. Definitely, you know, I can speak to some of the challenges we know we're facing. We are meeting the benchmarks we've established to date in the executive orders. The challenge we're seeing now is capacity, developing capacity for all the different types of providers we need to provide the supports to people as they go. So that's something we're going to be looking at very closely. But ultimately, I don't know what the next lawsuit is going to be. I don't want to know what the next lawsuit is going to be. So it's just moving, doing what we know we need to do, not only to honor our obligations in the settlement agreement, but also to honor what we know now CMS is saying to us. That one is going to be a difficult discussion. We've talked to all of our sheltered workshop providers about their plans to transform, because it's clear we know that when an individual has a provider that they've worked with for any number of years, they trust that provider. It's the provider agency and the staff they work with at that provider that they trust more than they trust me coming in and trying, or Acacia or Trina trying to come in and tell them anything. And so if we can get those providers on board, and many of them fortunately are on board and are working hard right now to figure out how to move forward to support integrated employment and other types of services that we're really looking at. And that's really where we're focused right now at this point, to expand our capacity, but also to build trust with the individuals and families who are involved in this process.
Let me add one more thing really quickly, Representative Stark. So Lilia touched on the ultimate where an individual is in the community and requires very little support. That's a complete continuum to the individuals who would require additional support. So when a person is working with my program, at some point we then transfer that long-term supports back over to developmental disabilities. So it's working together between our programs to be able to ensure that the providers that we have are providers for both of our programs, so we can have that seamless transition between. Now, is it always going to work 100% of the time like is on paper? No, unfortunately, but we're trying to hammer through those areas, and we've seen some great improvement, but I think that we have some additional opportunities in the future as we're trying to address capacity around the state, because as Senator Denbrough has mentioned earlier, and also Senator Cruz, that each community is so very specific and unique, and so the needs of that community is also going to be unique. So obviously we're trying to get to the ultimate goal where individuals require very little support, or that the support can naturally taper off as the person's skill level increases. But we also need to be realistic that the timeline for each individual is based upon that person and what they're able to, you know, to do and to be successful at.
And I think one of the things that's been interesting, again, for our family, my son is 21. He ends his school services on June 8th. He's a person with a moderate to severe intellectual disability. And I've had this internal struggle of my values and philosophy are totally with where Employment First is going. I would love to see all people integrated in the community and everybody at or above minimum wage. We've had that discussion before. And as we edged closer to Sam moving out, it got pretty scary, like what's going to happen. But we went through these
processes. We went through discovery. We had a whole team of people that came that weren't just our family that talked about how they knew him and what he could do, and he talked about what he could do. We learned that our expectations for him weren't as high as they should be, and other people saw skills that weren't there. This phenomenal job developer that went and took him out into the community trying different jobs, getting feedback from employers about what he was good at, what he needed work with, that collaboration with Voc Rehab and the school reformatting his IEP to build on those skills. And in the end, we just found out the week before last, the day that school ends, he's going to start his new job at Trader Joe's in the community as a stocking clerk at minimum wage, which is pretty exciting. He will have job coaching from Voc Rehab for that initial period of time. He has significant needs, so DD will come through and he'll have continued job coaching. And with that employment path process outside of the time that he's at work, he'll be going and doing volunteer activities in the community to continue building those skills so that he's able to move to a place where he needs less job coaching. So kind of seeing it applied with a person with significant needs has helped it make a lot more sense to me. And I think the other thing that helps is because we're ahead of the curve with the lawsuit and doing the employment first process, that front door is closing. So that means that the first adopters, the first people that are out there, aren't people that are in established communities and have a way of seeing things. So there will be less risk. There will be a lot of success stories that you're sending to us every other week of people in small communities and big cities across the state that are doing phenomenal things and get to save towards their goals. My son's goal is to buy a plane ticket to go to New York City so he can see Wicked yet again. Everybody has goals, so I appreciate your leadership.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbro.
Thanks. So just to clarify, so if an individual decides that they don't want to go into integrated employment, there could be a sort of volunteer route that they could go, and that would be acceptable under the federal programs. The challenge becomes their ability to be paid at subminimum wage. Is that sort of the nub of the problem?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dimbro, there's a lot of different services. We have two different categories, if you want to think about it that way. We have supported employment. We have individual integrated supported employment, which is at minimum wage or above. It's one person in a job like you or I would work. We also have supported small group, which is where up to 8 individuals who have intellectual and developmental disabilities can work in the community together, as long as it's at a community location and they're making minimum wage or above. We also have what's considered employment path services, which do not have a minimum wage requirement. The thing there, though, is, as Lilia was talking about, they're considered training services, and the purpose of them is to really help somebody explore different jobs, explore what they're interested in, to then move into supported employment. But you could have employment path community, which could be volunteering, or it could be taking classes. It could be a variety of different things that you're doing in the community to then hopefully move into supported employment. If you're not interested in pursuing individual integrated employment at all, that's when we have the dehabilitation programs that Lilia's talking about, which are community-based, hopefully, and they provide integration services, socialization, but also skill building, home living activities, that type of thing. The other thing that I think is really important to emphasize is that individuals have the right to change their mind, to make choices whenever they want. So somebody may be nearing the age of retirement and who has been working and is interested in looking at multiple services to plan for their retirement. Somebody may have just graduated. They may be interested in taking classes right now and want to pursue integrated employment years later. Some individuals we know have children, and they want to stay home to raise their children and then later are going to pursue integrated employment. So just like you or I, we try to make sure that they have the right to structure their day in their life as is what's going to work best for them.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds great. For those who are in the, you know, the training, the temporary potentially training setting where they're getting the subminimum wage, is there a time limit on how long they can be in a program like that?
Yeah, there is a time limit. Right now in the state of Oregon, we've written into our waiver to CMS. We've said that the time limit is based on the individual support plan. We'd really like to be as individualized as we can. So if somebody does a year of the service and has a specific goal and either doesn't meet that goal or has another goal to reach in that service, they can continue it the next year. The only caution I put out there is there are states who have been, well, who have set very specific time limits. They've said 1 year or 2 year, and CMS is very clear. It is a time limited service. service. And so we do have to make sure we're striking that balance. And when we say it's time limited, that we really have measurable goals for individuals and that we're meeting those goals and tracking to see how that service is best fitting their needs.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Senator Gelser, for being so patient with this lowly House member. I really hope I'm wrong on this. I'm thinking back to, you know, many of the residents in an adult foster home I used to work in, and five of the six, I'm thinking back, they'd probably do fantastic. They would need help, and if there's one guy in specifically, the number one reason I actually quit that job, and I'm viewing him, and I'm thinking, are there people like this man who are successful now, that regardless of heroic efforts, that in 2 to 5 years from now, they say the amount of need is greater than we can provide, and that he's going to end up staying home with mom. And when all said and done, for that really small, I know it's just a small little portion of the population that I'm talking about. I'm not saying the whole, that there's going to be this small portion that ends up staying home or just volunteering or something where they felt like they were making a living, now they're not. And I think that, and I'm concerned about that for their own value and self-worth. I'm also concerned about that for the state in 5 to 10 years, that small population is going to then flip it back around and say, you were providing us employment, now you're not. And that we end up, and I know we can't speculate on all the potential lawsuits out there, but so I hope I'm wrong, but I've voiced my frustration.
Chair, yeah, I was going to say Chair Gelser. I don't know if that. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and I will be sending this email from these parents. But will there be a database, or will you be tracking data of these thousands of people that are going to be in Employment First, and how many are really going to be working the 20 hours a week or more, and about the number of day habilitation centers and the number of people there? I mean, will we be tracking those types of things?
Chair Gelser, Senator Monis-Anderson, I would say that one of the benefits of having a settlement agreement is that we are going to be doing, and we are doing now, and we'll continue to do, and we'll do even more of the kind of data tracking that you're talking about.
Yeah.
It is, I can say already from just our early conversations, we just recently got an independent reviewer who will be working with both the plaintiffs and the state on the settlement agreement. And I can say with confidence that based on our early discussions and initial questions, that data and our ability to show data and track individuals and track what's happening is going to be critical to that process. So we have that. We've built systems for that purpose already, but I know in the future they're going to be further refined and definitely give us the tools we need to look at things from that perspective.
And Lilia, just to be clear that I'm understanding this the right way, the settlement does not close sheltered workshops. The biggest change for the sheltered workshops is being faced by every state in the country because of change in the home and community-based rules, and starting in 2019, March of 2019, we lose our Medicaid match. We will no longer be able to provide that as a service for which we get a 60% match.
Yeah, for these Senator Chair Gelser, yes, that is a good way to summarize it. For these services, our match, we get the Medicaid waiver service match that it is 64%. So for every dollar we put in, the federal government matches us at 64% of that, or every 32. I can't do quick math, but we put in a little bit, and they put in 64 cents. It equals a dollar. Sorry. So that is exactly true. And if you look at the settlement agreement, if you look at the benchmarks that are laid out in the settlement agreement about people transitioning into integrated employment from sheltered workshops, even when you get to the very end of the benchmarks for the settlement agreement, that it didn't go down to zero. It left a population of people still in sheltered workshops. The bigger issue is what came in to play from CMS while we were in the midst of that lawsuit, which is the home community-based settings regulation. populations and the expectations built into those around what they will and will not fund for integrated employment sidings in the future, starting about March 2019.
And so for if we aren't planning ahead to work on transitions and transformation grants mm-hmm. for provider agencies, and we get to March 1st, 2019, and we have not accommodated for people to continue doing that, we would have to make that all up with general fund. And for every dollar we'd spend, we'd have to spend two more. So we'd triple our cost, basically.
Chair Gelser, yes. That is that's one of the cost implications, pricing things that we're looking at is what happens after that point. Assuming that we're still working to transition people from shelter workshop settings, what are the budgetary implications?
Thank you all very much, and thanks for coming to Lebanon. They came and did a fantastic presentation at one of our local sheltered workshops and answered a lot of questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. With that, we are going to close our information update on Employment First update. Is Megan here yet? Yes. All right. We are going to open up our informational meeting on a child care systems overview. And we're running a little behind. We need 10 minutes at the end for ODVA, so we have, including questions, about a half hour.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get started while we're orienting things because I have an opening that doesn't need PowerPoint. So.
Oh, great.
Rhonda has a PowerPoint for later. So, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Early Learning System Director at the Department of Education. And I'm here today with colleagues from DHS to discuss the interaction and partnership between the Early Learning Division and the Department of Human Services as it relates to the regulation of our state's child care system. And there are two places where the Department of Human Services and the Early Learning Division interact on child care. The first is the administration of the state's employment-related daycare program, and the second is the investigation of child abuse or neglect allegations in licensed child care centers and homes. We'll talk through these both. We're going to begin with employment-related daycare. So just a little context on this quickly before I hand it over to Rhonda. The Early Learning Division is the administrator of the Federal Child Care Development Fund, which is a block grant that comes to states to do three things: support the regulation of child care to ensure health and safety for children, support quality improvement in child care to make sure that children are in the best, most educational environments possible, and then probably most importantly, the CCDF grant supports states to provide child care subsidies to low-income working families to make child care more affordable. And the bulk of the state's CCDF funding goes toward that purpose. So the division's responsible for licensing and monitoring child care, overseeing compliance to rules, conducting background checks, and supporting the ongoing training of providers. DHS is responsible for the administration of the subsidy program, and for this part of the presentation, I'm going to hand it to Rhonda Prudzinski to walk you through more information on that.
Great. Good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rhonda Prudzinski. I'm the Child Care and Refugee Program Manager with Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs at Department of Human Services. So we'll start out with our outline for our presentation. And we were asked to come and provide some background information on the employment-related daycare program today. And I thank you for allowing us this time on the agenda. These are the values we're working for. The employment-related daycare program is a dual-generational approach, giving families access to high-quality child care. It helps parents retain employment, and it supports healthy child development and school success. Our program currently is serving under 15,000 children and less than 8,000 families. This is less than 16% of the eligible children or families in Oregon. We had to activate our reservation list in January of 2016. Each month, over 400 families are added to our reservation list. Historically, our caseload has dropped about 400 cases or families per month, but in recent months, this has only been about 100. This is really due to the policy changes we made in October of 2015 with the passage of the Employment-Related Daycare Bill, House Bill 2015, which has really stabilized our program. This is really great news for the families we serve, but it means the reservation list may need to be activated longer than initially anticipated. We've been seeing some trends with the program. Our cost per case continues to increase each year, and more families are transitioning from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program to our employment-related daycare program, which is really wonderful news. Also, the number of subsidy children in licensed care has been increasing over the last several years also. So increasing the level of quality and stability of child care settings has been a primary focus of the program. This is a very exciting time with the child care system in Oregon. In November of 2014, the Child Care Development Block Grant was reauthorized. And this really has enabled states to improve health and safety of children in care. And it also provides us with the ability to have more family-friendly subsidy policies. With House Bill 2015, Speaker Kotek and the Oregon Legislature made a significant investment in the program. We have many improvements for our families. You can see four major changes. These are really benefiting families by increasing stability as well as access, which are our program values. We've already seen a reduction in our attrition rate, which I mentioned earlier. Back in 2012, Oregon State University, Dr. Bobby Weber, did a subsidy study. And with the families she studied, she found that many of the parents went on and off the program. There wasn't much stability. And in addition to that, they went from one low-paying job to another. Our goal with these changes is for more parents to have the opportunity to increase their skills, get better jobs, and move out of poverty. Improvements for providers. So we also have many improvements for our providers. We have already increased our provider rates, and beginning in April, we have new incentives for providers that are quality rated. Provider training will also be enhanced to improve health and safety. And we've been working really closely with the Early Learning Division as well as the Child Care Division on all these changes. All these are supporting our values of safety, quality, and school readiness. One of the outcomes for our federal funding is that funds are used effectively, efficiently, and with integrity to benefit all eligible children and families. Previously, we did not do any visits, and the lack of focus on a financial review had impact and compromised the integrity of our program. We began unannounced inspections in February of this year. We took a voluntary action because we recognized a gap. With existing funds, we started a pilot with one investigator. Currently, our visits are focused on licensed providers and ones that are receiving higher amounts of payment from DHS each month. These visits provide an opportunity for one-on-one education as well as prevention. We really have appreciated the support that we've gotten for the pilot. Inspection results. So here's what we've seen so far. Most of our providers have been in compliance, but there were some that did have multiple issues. And for those, they received technical assistance. Some of the concerns were missing immunization records, missing or incomplete attendance logs, or other health and safety violations. Some of these could be corrected the same day. So we had a couple providers that their smoke detectors weren't working, and so that was something that was easily remedied. We notify the Office of Child Care at the Early Learning Division of any follow-up issues that need to be taken care of. So they provide corrective action and technical assistance. So again, with missing immunization records, if we had a person on site that wasn't on the background check registry or other health and safety violations. Our employment-related daycare inspector also will do follow-up visits for issues such as missing attendance logs, because we want to make sure they're in compliance. Providers can be placed in suspension status for not meeting our DHS requirements. Examples of this would be refusing an inspection, not keeping attendance logs, or not complying with other DHS requirements. Providers can be immediately placed into a disqualified status if there's an imminent danger situation. All of these providers do have hearing rights if they're removed from our approved status. And we also will refer providers to our overpayment unit or to our fraud investigation unit if necessary.
And can I ask a clarifying question?
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between your approved status and the child care license. So am I correct? If the child care has a license and they're serving non-ERDC kids, that doesn't mean that they're no longer able to provide care. It means they're not eligible to receive subsidy from DHS for failure to comply with DHS regulations and rules.
Correct. Child Gelster, that is correct.
But it does not shut down the business. If they're providing other care or people.
That is correct. One other thing I wanted to mention, too, if a provider is no longer able to care for substitute children, we work really closely with our child care resource and referrals. If we have children that have special needs, we work really closely with the Inclusive Child Care Program also. We also have done surveys of providers that received inspections, and we received a lot of positive feedback, which was great. For next steps, we're developing an online training, and this will be used to educate providers on the DHS requirements, and we've gotten some really great feedback from our unions on that. And we'll continue to work with the employment or the Early Learning Division to ensure our work aligns with provider eligibility and monitoring visits. And I can take any questions now if you have any.
Representative Stark has questions.
I'm trying so hard to not have questions.
I don't think that's possible.
Well, thank you, Chair Gelser. House Bill 2015, Section 4. Was added because there was it directed the Early Learning Division in consultation with the Department of Human Services to do a study to find out if incentivizing the quality incentives, if that would have a negative impact on family relationships. So the concern was if we say you choose a quality, someone who's met all these standards, if you choose them, you have a financial incentive as a parent to choose them, and that would have a negative impact on some of the relative caregivers and cause people to not choose relative caregivers. How is that study coming along? Any progress, any results, that sort of thing?
Megan, I'll turn this over to you.
Sure. Chair Gelser, Representative Stark, members of the committee, the study's in progress. The tiered reimbursements are pretty new in implementation, so there's no real results to report currently. Let me go ahead and check with my staff to find out what the full study timeline looks like and share that back with you.
Other questions at this point?
Stop.
All right, please continue to the next part.
Great. Just writing that down so I wouldn't forget.
Yes. Thank you.
So thank you, Rhonda. As I shared at the outset, the Early Learning Division also works with the Department of Human Services around investigation of allegations of abuse or neglect in licensed child care centers or homes. The Office of Child Care is responsible for investigating complaints about care to determine whether one of our rules has been violated. And if a rule is violated and we can prove it, our office has the authority to issue a citation, require corrective action of the violation, to suspend a license or revoke a license. And we also have the ability to suspend individuals from our central background registry, which effectively bars them from providing child care in Oregon. Often the complaints that get called into our office and investigated
or that are observed by our licensing staff when they're out doing monitoring visits are pretty routine or straightforward. A provider is out of ratio. A provider has someone in their home who's not in the central background registry. Those are serious violations. Sometimes we find things like a provider left Febreze out on the counter, which according to our rules is technically a toxic, but that is the kind of thing, just in like Ron's smoke detector example, that you can correct on site. Sometimes the complaints that come into our office are much more serious, and those are complaints of abuse, neglect, or harm that has come to a child in childcare. And these allegations come to our office in one of three ways. A parent or a mandatory reporter or someone associated with the childcare sees something that they don't think is okay and they call us. When this happens, we immediately notify and report to DHS Child Welfare and to law enforcement. The second way that we can find out that something's happened is that DHS Child Welfare notifies us that they have an investigation underway with one of our licensed providers. And then the third way that we find out is law enforcement notifies us that an investigation's underway. And because our licensing staff at the Office of Child Care are not trained in investigating abuse or neglect investigations, because that is not part of the legislative charge of our agency, when this information comes to us, we work very closely with the child welfare staff and law enforcement, and we depend on the outcome of those investigations to decide what action we are allowed to take. When an investigation is ongoing, we stay in close contact with the investigators, and we share information that we have with them on the provider's compliance history. So before we turn the discussion of what happens on the child care licensing side once an investigation is completed, I wanted to give colleagues from DHS the opportunity to share what happens on their end as they're conducting that investigation, and then I'll come back to what happens after that concludes. There's three scenarios that happen for us in that case as well.
Good. Yep. Good morning. My name is Stacy Ayers. I manage the Child Safety Program, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I am just going to give you a real brief kind of overview of the process. As you know, the statute requires that the department conduct investigations in daycare facilities. And so that begins with a report to the child abuse hotline. The report will then be screened. A decision is made about whether it meets the statutory definition of an allegation. And whether it is a closed report or an assigned report, which means that it's going to be investigated, in any event, that report is then communicated. There's some communication that takes place between the Department of Human Services, the hotline screener who's received the report, and with the Early Learning Division. So that report is then sent over to them if it's closed or whether it's assigned. At the point of assignment, that information is communicated. An assessment will then be conducted by a trained CPS worker, Child Protective Services worker. We'll make contact with the alleged victim, with the daycare provider, and with the alleged victim's parents, and make determinations about whether or not abuse happened, whether it's founded or whether it is unfounded, or potentially whether it's an unable to determine disposition. At the conclusion of the investigation, go back to the investigation piece of this, that will often be done through interviews and collateral contacts, and at times it may involve having experts and such as a designated medical provider seeing a child to make a determination of whether, say, injuries that are observed or found on a child are consistent with child abuse. At the conclusion of an assessment, the information is then, and I should say that this is kind of along the way, there's going to be coordination and collaboration between the child abuse, child protective services worker, and the early learning division, department of, I think it's the compliance unit, to coordinate kind of efforts and what we're doing and how the investigation is going. The other piece that I hadn't mentioned and I'd want to point out to you all is that the statute also requires that the investigation take place in coordination with law enforcement. So oftentimes there's another element of this, of the investigation that is occurring as well. So with that said, very brief overview, if you have questions for me, I'm happy to answer.
So I have a question. We, Megan and Dr. Richardson and I had the opportunity to sit with a family that went through this process, and I have a lot of questions that I can follow up with you about later, but one of them had to do with the parents' right to know what happened to the child. Mm-hmm. So we sat in a room in which everyone in this room had read the investigation report of what had happened to this woman's child. Okay. There is a police report that the police detective tells me includes 21 investigations, but the mother is told she cannot know anything that's in the record because child abuse investigations are confidential. But she is the mother of the child. Yeah. But DHS won't let her see the record. Law enforcement won't let her see the police records. Is there a way around that where we can let parents know what's happened? I mean, she's got a child with really significant injuries, and trying to help the child, it would be helpful to her, and I imagine other parents in other situations, to have the information that has been gleaned. And I think she's left with the perception that absolutely nothing happened afterwards because nobody can show her. She doesn't have a piece of paper that says this is what happened to your child.
Yeah. So, Chair Gelser, thank you for that question. I think that that's probably a fundamental misunderstanding of our ability to share information with the parent of a child who's been a victim of child abuse. So I'd be happy to talk with you more about any, you know, case-specific questions that you might have and follow up with you about processes that may be in place to help a parent in that situation.
Okay. And then the other question that came up in that situation, it wasn't OWAPI that went out and did the investigation. It was CPS. Mm-hmm. And that CPS worker basically made the determination that the child had a protective parent and wasn't going to be in that situation anymore, which kind of works when you're talking about a family. Mm-hmm. But in a child care, that child comes out. And in this case, you had a kid that was beaten all across the back of his head. He had bruises up and down his torso.
Right.
Somebody else is going to go into that facility. But because the investigation wasn't completed, and law enforcement said they waited for months for the report from CPS, but the response was the child is now safe, Megan didn't have the ability to take any action on the license. Is there a way to improve that without statute so those CPS workers are looking at the systemic risk to many children instead of this child isn't going back to that child care facility anymore, so we don't have to finish the process?
I think there likely is, and I'd be happy to have, again, some other conversations with you about the specifics in that case, but I think that there is an ability by the department to the statute is really clear, and 419B035, it gives the department the discretion to release information that is necessary to prevent or treat or protect children from child abuse. And so that means that other parents are going to continue taking their child into a situation that is unsafe or dangerous or would lead to that child being another child being abused. I think that it's incumbent upon the department to intervene in a way that is going to protect those other children as well.
So. Thank you. All right, Megan.
So once that investigation is completed by child welfare and law enforcement, there are three possible outcomes on the Office of Child Care side. The allegation is substantiated, and when that happens, we initiate revocation of the business license and enrollment in our central background registry for the perpetrator. The allegation is unfounded, and when that happens, we don't move forward with revocation. Our licensing staff do a monitoring visit to make sure that the environment is safe and healthy and compliant with child care rules. And if it is, we don't take action on a license or CBR, Central Background Registry. And the third one is trickier, and it's what you were just referring to, Senator Gelser. The allegation comes back unable to determine. And that becomes a gray area for the Early Learning Division because there are perhaps some indications that abuse has occurred, but not enough evidence to say for sure, or not enough evidence to say where or who specifically abused or neglected the child. And while the child who was possibly abused or neglected might be safe from harm at that point, the division also has to consider the safety of other children in care. And if an allegation isn't proven, it becomes really difficult for us to use what is written down from those from the CPS and law enforcement investigation to initiate revocation of a license. So when that happens, our licensing staff will do, again, a monitoring visit, talk to the provider and the parent, check to make sure that rules are being followed. If they're not, we cite for that under the authority of our rules and statutes. If they are, we also have to file a report of the complaint being unable to substantiate. We do step up unannounced monitoring visits to see if there's anything that we can see or substantiate if it's an environment that seems potentially unsafe for the children that are left there. We are always grateful when a child who was or may have been abused in childcare is moved to a place where he or she is safe. We're often left worrying about the other children in care. In these instances, again, we have to be able to prove that a specific rule violation occurred. Sometimes we'll be able to pursue an investigation relating to something like inadequate supervision. So, for example, if we had a case where a child was bit extensively beyond what, you know, there are, you know, as a child's developing, some of them are biters, but you would see one bite or two bites. If you have a child that was bitten extensively to the point where we can demonstrate that inadequate supervision was happening, then we can make a strong enough case, typically at hearing, to have the license revoked. I am almost done. I just wanted to say for the record that I really do understand that child care providers are business owners and therefore entitled to due process rights under the Constitution. And this gray area that we're talking about leaves me in a place as the director of the Early Learning Division where I'm concerned and really exploring what, if any, additional regulatory, statutory authority do we need to keep the kids who are left in a safe environment. And we're in active conversation with the Department of Justice about that, as well as conversation with them about where we could do some changes in practice or evidence collection that won't require a regulatory change. And on the regulatory side, we're hopeful that we can work with this committee as we go into the next session and as we know more about what is legally possible that we could do that we don't currently have the authority to do. And so with that, I can answer any questions that you have. I have a colleague from DOJ here to help too if necessary, since I'm not a lawyer and I'm about able to explain they have due process rights that we can't violate, and so there's a hearing process and may need a little help from my friend if the questions are more legally complex.
But just to be clear, in terms of the list that you're working with DOJ, you'll be able to bring back to the committee statutory fixes that you need that might be similar to 1515 to make sure that you have the tools that the legislature gave to child welfare a few months ago to be able to address very similar issues.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, that's correct. We're just working through it. Right now it's a little more complicated than I wish that it was, but we want to get it right.
Thank you.
Just quickly, Madam Chair. Megan, in those areas that where the report is inconclusive but concerning, and the provider comes under a kind of a heightened scrutiny period, do you have statistics on what, you know, what has happened? I mean, how many follow-up visits happen, unanticipated, unannounced visits, and the extent to which they actually lead to discovery of something that's clearly concerning.
Chair Gelser, Senator Dimbro, members of the committee, I can get that information for you. What I have today is just the number of CPS or law enforcement agency cases that we were involved in over the course of the last year, and it was 161. We have a very outdated data system. I tried to pull information for you on how many were substantiated and what that looked like, and we actually weren't able to get that out of our data system. I will look and see if I can provide information to you on what happens after that stepped-up monitoring.
Okay. Great, thank you.
And just as a clarification, I think for both of you on the inconclusive or the unable to determine, I think what hadn't occurred to me before we went through this one process was that unable to determine is not necessarily a finding that unable to determine that abuse occurred. Mm-hmm. That finding could simply be, yes, we clearly abuse occurred, we just can't identify which adult in the child care committed the abuse, that it's clear the child was abused in care, mm-hmm. and that can lead to an unable to determine. And that was a surprise to me.
Yes, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, appears that was directed toward me.
Yeah, make sure I'm getting the description right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair assessment of the kind of the definition. We really try to not use unable to determine as a disposition as much as possible, because it really leaves people within a state of kind of flux of not knowing who is this about and who are we kind of leaning towards. And so to the degree possible, if we are able to, reasonable cause is a very low standard or low burden, low threshold. And if we are able to get to, we believe it is this, and we believe this is the person who did it, that's what we try to push toward. You're never going to be 100%. And so we have a very small number of all the investigations that we do that do result in unable to determine.
Any further questions? Thank you very, very much. And many thanks to Megan and Dr. Richardson for just really being really responsive on this issue. And this family that came forward, I think we've all learned a lot from them, and it took a lot of courage for them. And I'll follow up with you, because I think it would be great if she could access some of the records about her own child.
Senator Gulls, I'd be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to close our informational hearing on the child care systems overview and at long last open the informational hearing on services for aging veterans. And we have the incredible Cameron Smith and Mary Yeager, who have waited so patiently for hours. Thank you. And hi back there, Lori Skillman is in the room as well.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and we just have an hour-long presentation here for you this morning. We are frequently, as a department and as a veterans community, in front of the Senate Veterans Committee, with both Senator Monta Sanderson sitting on that and Senator Alan Olson, and staffed by Cheyenne, frequently on the House veterans side, but not often in front of the Human Services and Housing side for both Senate and House committees. But a lot of crossover work in our shared efforts. As advocates for veterans at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, we care about the policy, the budgets, and the outcomes for Oregon veterans, for their health, their education, their economic opportunity. And that crosses agencies, it crosses partners, and it crosses committees' work. And just briefly, our greatest opportunity in serving our veterans, we have 320,000 plus veterans across the state, urban and rural, men and women, every ethnicity and creed, a real kaleidoscope of Oregon citizens. But our greatest opportunity, only about a third of Oregon veterans access what are largely their federal VA benefits, and a tremendous opportunity for us to better identify veterans, connect them to their earned benefits, draw down and leverage those federal VA resources, and further extend limited general fund resources to serve all Oregonians. We most often hear about my generation of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans in the news. But 52% of our veterans served in Vietnam, World War II, Korea-era generation. Vietnam veterans are our largest segment of our veterans population, did not receive a welcome home in their own time, and are now experiencing significant issues as they age. And just amazing, as a department, we stood up in 1945, so 70 years strong, right after World War II, but we are still serving those World War II veterans, no longer those returning service members and going to school on the GI Bill, but still serving for those still with us, serving them 70-odd years later in a much different capacity. And as a baby-faced agency director, I have to convince my more senior veterans that I have a permission slip from my parents to be the director. So fortunate to have on Team ODVA a true advocate for seniors across all Oregonians, but especially our aging veterans and all veterans, Ms. Mary Yeager.
So, Chair Gelser and committee members, I submitted some testimony in advance, and given our 5 minutes that we have left to go, if I could just share three major points with you. One is that I've spent about a year now at ODVA, and literally I feel like a human services advocate embedded in a team that is working with veterans. I had no idea that there were so many human services causes being touched at ODVA by some really amazing people, and particularly in the world of aging. So the agency has charge of two all-veteran nursing homes, one in the Dalles, built in the late 90s, brand new one in Lebanon, been open about a year and a half, at the time was the newest in the country. The next one on board in the Northwest will be Walla Walla, side note. The agency also is serves as conservator and representative payee for almost 300 other veterans. So even being an advocate in the state of Oregon for seniors, people with disabilities, I had no idea literally until I got to the agency that there was this kind of service being provided. And in human services terms, really those are about 300 people for whom institutionalization has been pushed away. And but for the people at ODVA doing this amazing work, those folks would be on their own. You might think it's all seniors, and actually it isn't. Spouses, kids, sometimes called the helpless children under Title 38, who were children of literally World War II veterans who have been under the protection of the agency for that long. But again, preventing the institutionalization that you heard about in earlier hearings. So I guess I would finally like to leave you with what Cameron touched on, which is the idea of veteran benefits for elderly and aging Oregonian veterans. As a human services and aging person, in my mind, getting veteran benefits was something akin to Medicare. So complicated, probably you have to call an 800 number, get put on hold, someone will come back to you, but eventually you get that benefit. And I will tell you, I was completely wrong, as are all of my colleagues in the aging and human services world. So, little pop quiz. Do you know or are you aware that it is actually a limited power of attorney that you as a veteran give to that veteran service officer so that they can advocate for your rightfully earned benefits to the federal VA? In other words, yes, you can try to do that benefit opportunity at home, but it's sort of like representing yourself in court. You know, you may be really good at being a pretend lawyer, but none of us are probably very good at being a pretend veteran service officer. Huge eye-opener. So if we look at the 50,000 licensed long-term care beds in Oregon, how many of those are housing veterans? And if we were to take just one veteran off of Medicaid and shift them to their rightfully deserved federal benefits, that would probably pay for two veteran service officers. So that shift from general fund to federal is far more dramatic than certainly I realized, and maybe you all were aware, but I just wanted to come and share just a few of those ideas. And now I will stop because you really are running close to the wire. Thanks for letting
us. Thank you so much. Any questions before you leave and they leave?
I'm glad to see the integration, because really we need wraparound services.
Absolutely.
And our veterans shouldn't be just being dealt with veterans, because so many of them are in our community and not being well served. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm glad you're at ODVA.
Thank you. I am too.
Good asset pickup there.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, also we marked the paces between Director Psyche's building and our ODVA headquarters, 222 paces by my steps. Simply integrating those two big worlds is one step, but then integrating the community partners and up and down the chain of governments from tribal to counties up to the feds, nothing but opportunity. So thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thanks so much for coming. And with that, we'll close that informational hearing. Thank you all for staying the whole time. We covered a lot of stuff. And with that, we are adjourned.